Hello and welcome to the Das Nostalgia Podcast, episode 9. I'm your host, Anatoly, and today I have another very special guest with me. Sir, please introduce yourself.
Sure thing. I'm Chris Olson, on Twitter as CGO Apps, and a flight simulator enthusiast. Been playing or kind of using flight simulators since the early to mid 80s, all the way of course, the present day. And I've been flying real aircraft since 1997 and presently employed as an airline pilot. And I've been doing that since 2001.
All right. That is very impressive. And, well, what are we going to talk about today, sir?
Well, we're going to talk about flight simulators.
Oh, yes.
quite a few on the list. And I'm going to try to highlight some that, you know, of course, you see a lot of coverage of, you know, the more recent flight simulators. But staying in the DOS realm, there are some from kind of the mid-80s that I don't want to say they're forgotten, but and certainly looking back, they don't look all that great graphically or anything like that. But they were able to accomplish an amazing amount of realism from, you know, from in certain ways. And I want to make sure those don't get forgotten, and then kind of just go through the years and highlight ones that I really enjoy, that I can, you know, will have certain moments in the airplane where I'll think to myself, you know, the first time I learned this or had exposure to this was through a flight simulator. So, so that's what I'm hoping to chat about.
All right. Well, very nice. But I guess before we go into the main topic, I'm going to ask you what I ask just about everyone who comes onto the show is, do you remember your first experience with the sort of, you know, computers, games, and specifically IBM PC or compatible?
Yeah, I sure do. And this is an appropriate question because I was very fortunate. My household growing up had a computer starting in, I want to say, late 1979. I'm 35 years old, so had a computer from a pretty early age. Now, that was an 8-bit Atari computer, which I know is not the subject of this podcast, but my first exposure to an actual IBM PC was, I want to say it had to be in the early 80s, so we're probably talking maybe 1983, and it was just an 8086 Hercules graphics card, you know, monochrome graphics, and it was actually a little bit of a funny story. It was at a family reunion in Wisconsin. And I was, growing up, I was just very, very allergic to dogs and cats. So we couldn't stay with the rest of the family. We had to stay in, it was actually a relative's home office. And he had a computer. And I just remember going, Dad, you know, hey, can we turn this on and see, you know, what's on there? And, you know, my dad begrudgingly said, okay. And one of the things that they had was Microsoft Flight Simulator 1.0 and 2.0. So for 15 minutes before going to bed, I actually got to play both of those, and that is, as far as I can remember, my very first encounter with an actual, you know, MS-DOS machine. It wouldn't be until many years later that we would actually purchase one of those for home use. We had we went through a couple of different computers in the interim, but yeah, so that's I will always remember that. And when you asked me that question, I thought, gosh, you know what? That really was it. It was the first two versions of Flight Simulator. So, yeah.
Nice. Well, I guess take it away.
All right. Sounds good. Well, as I kind of mentioned in the intro there, let's start with the civilian sims and try to talk about a couple of these and really highlight the early ones a little bit, because I know people probably won't be as familiar, or if they are, it'll be kind of a distant memory. But
right.
We already chatted about Flight Simulator a little bit. I'll get into that because that is a really a large topic that has it looks like really about 6 versions before they went away from DOS, and you know, spanning, you know, I think, gosh, about 13 or 14 years. But the first one I actually want to talk about is a MicroProse product called SoloFlight. And this was a Sid Meier product long before Sid Meier was putting his actual name on things. And it wasn't the first product that MicroProse did, but boy, it was close. The premise was they wanted to recreate the same routes that mail pilots, U.S. airmail pilots, flew in the 20s and the 30s. And of course, Charles Lindbergh was one of the, you know, more famous airmail pilots, and it was a really, really ambitious game or simulator. And you only had one airplane that you could fly, and the only hint that you got besides the manual, which was actually done pretty well, that you were really flying one of these mail routes was you'd get kind of the loading screen and the intro screen, and then you could just kind of cycle through which mail route you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And they had they had certainly Kansas and some of the Midwest modeled to where you could go from, all right, we're going to go from Wichita, Kansas to, let's say, St. Louis, Missouri. And, you'd start up and take off. And, of course, you could select the weather. Is it really foggy? Is it cloudy? Is it nighttime, daytime? And that was pretty much it. The beauty of Soloflight, though, was, graphically, especially on the PC, it was a little bit more colorful on some of the other platforms. But on the PC, we're talking very, very rudimentary graphics.
Yeah, and, CGA colors. And
It's actually a shame, not to stray from the DOS topic, but actually Soloflight, I think, was out for just about every platform at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised. I went, wow, that's true CGA in all its glory. I said, wow, that is really something. But the brilliance of Soloflight was you could actually navigate without looking outside, and there really wasn't much scenery to see out there anyway. But this concept of VOR navigation or station-to-station navigation was modeled very, very well. It was so realistically that you could actually execute an instrument approach and pop out of the clouds and see the runway. That was the first time I was able to do that and actually, look at the instrumentation and selecting a radial and hone in on the airport. It was just remarkable. And I really didn't appreciate it at the time, but looking back, that is pretty much what we still do today. Certainly we have GPS and the technology has evolved quite a bit, considering also that the technology being modeled in Soloflight was roughly, even though it kind of has the this notion of airmail at its core, the aircraft modeled was like a two-seat Cessna or a small propeller aircraft. So, we've been talking about, kind of several levels of technology and going back a ways. But what really did it was the instrumentation, the attention to detail, the realism, and the fact that in that small, relatively, somewhat benign world of several states and very, very Spartan scenery and whatnot, this notion of navigation, which really was at the heart of all the airmail stuff anyway, what was just spot on. And that in the early 80s was just was really fantastic. So certainly that ability was there in some of the other simulators, but I really felt like Soloflight, it almost approached it in like a slightly instructional manner. The manual and the packaging, the whole way the game was designed, it really, stopping short of saying, we're going to teach you this, it presented it in a way that made it interesting and enjoyable for pilots and non-pilots alike. And there was just this really, kind of the notion of delivering the mail was just enough of a hook for, to add in that little bit of kind of extra incentive that really differentiated it from just the boilerplate, simulators that were out there. And really that was, at the time, it was just Microsoft Flight Simulator, or I guess in the 8-bit world, it was the Sublogic Flight Simulator. Microsoft, of course, licensed that, but we'll get into that. Right. But Soloflight's one of those where it's probably nuts to think, but it would be it seems to be very common these days to see kind of reboots of games, and I would maybe from an instructional standpoint, it would be great to see a reboot of Soloflight and make it a full blown kind of airmail simulator. I actually think if the flight sim world ever does kind of get back off the ground, it's been kind of an interesting, maybe it's four or five years behind the whole adventure game paradigm where, the supposedly the era was dead and is kind of coming back. And maybe with all this new VR stuff, maybe flight simulators are going to go down that same road. But a kind of fully realized airmail simulator would be something that I think would probably generate some attention. I don't know how well it translates into sales, but I would love to see a true, or maybe an inspired by Soloflight, because really, No other game as far, or simulator as far as I can tell, came anywhere near that. And it was definitely one that left an impression. That was the first kind of simulator that I encountered that really, kind of planted the seed for, you know, kind of honing this interest in aviation. And that's one that is definitely comes to mind, and that I know it was a long time ago, but just nobody remembers it. You know, you go through, you name off all the, you know, the more famous MicroProse products, and yeah, no one even remembers that that was even out there. So
yeah, that is really interesting, especially considering, you know, Sid Meier's involvement. You know, it's 1985, and they were already trying something rather different. You know, instead of flying a jet, you know, like the whole airmail angle, of course, is very interesting. Not to mention, it's it plays in the like sort of third person view, where where most other things, like you have your gauges at the bottom of the screen, but the actual viewport is not from the cockpit. It's from a third person, which also is very unusual. Even that early on, like that early on, most simulators actually stuck to, you know, the actual pilot view, not the plane view.
That's a really good point. That's true. And in fact, that feature, that ability to see the airplane, which, I mean, it seems kind of ridiculous now to go, oh, of course you'd be able to see the airplane.
Right.
Just hit the view button and scale out. That actually did not appear in certainly in the Microsoft Flight Simulator sense till several versions.
Mm-hmm.
And right around the same time, I don't know, you know, it's hard to know who, you know, who copied who or whatever, but one of the Chuck Yeager simulators was somewhat revolutionary in that you could actually, you know, as if you were standing and controlling the aircraft, you know, you could actually see it and it would come by. But that whole notion of being able to see the plane and see it react, even if it was rudimentary, was really something. And of course, if there were clouds, you couldn't see anything, which was, well, that's how it's supposed to be. But you'd pop out of the clouds, you'd look at the gauges, look, you'd say, oh, there's the airplane, there's the runway, great, we're gonna, you know, we're gonna land. So, I'd forgotten that, that's right. And that was, maybe a little bit ahead of their time, because it really didn't appear in other games for a couple of years at least. So that's true.
Yeah, simulators were always the most technically impressive games back in the day. I guess by necessity, but also it's very interesting to see how far they could push this very limited technology. I mean, all those early games, just like the original couple of MS Flight simulators and the, you know, games like Solo Flight, really ran on nothing, like on literally almost hopes and dreams, because it's those machines were so just primitive, and it's amazing how far people actually managed to push those hardware limitations.
All right, well, the next one I've got here is the behemoth of Microsoft Flight Simulator, and I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but it is kind of the preeminent civilian simulator, and I just want to maybe mention a little bit or discuss some memories of the you know, the various versions. Of course, I've got my first PC story about, you know, Flight Simulator 1.
That actually seems to be a lot of people's story. Like, in fact, most people who I asked on this podcast seem to point in the direction of the original Flight Simulator.
Not to to delve into prior podcast territory, but Microsoft Flight Simulator 1 and 2, I think, have the dubious distinction of being in the top 10 pirated games of all time, or at least in that era. I mean, it was popular, and I mean, it was, despite booter, it was everywhere. And I remember this at the time, but I had to be reminded of it in trying to look up a few things. But the, you know, Microsoft Flight Simulator 1.0, which it's worth mentioning a little bit, the company that actually developed the really most of the versions of Microsoft Flight Simulator is a company called Sublogic, and the guy behind it all was a guy named Bruce Artwick. And what actually happened was Sublogic released Flight Simulator 1.0, and then, strangely enough, Flight Simulator 2 with the little, you know, the Roman numerals or whatever, before Microsoft got permission and actually licensed and basically ported, 1.0 over to the PC. So that version appeared under the Sublogic name before Microsoft basically just, you know, it was certainly you know, early 80s Microsoft, very common practice to do this. But Sublogic was actually approached by Microsoft to say, it's almost exactly, as far as I can understand it, what happened with King's Quest and the PC Junior, where Microsoft actually approached Bruce Hartwick and Sublogic and said, we need a great, basically a killer game to really kind of sell the 8086. And, you know, this product is what can do it. Are you interested? That sort of thing. So, so that was kind of brought over. But it's weird because it exists in a very strict kind of regimented version control, 1.0 and 2.0. But if you talk about that on other platforms, it's a little bit it gets very muddy to keep track of all that. So
right.
1.0 is, boy, I mean, it's I'm trying to think of an arcade equivalent. I mean, it is maybe the very, very first Star Wars game or something where you've got very, I mean, it's not even vector graphics. It's just wireframe graphics. And,
yeah, it's very rudimentary. And it doesn't really feel like you're flying anything. Physics are way off. And technically, I guess, is it even a game? Because there isn't really, like, it's a simulator, I guess, in the pure simulator sense. I guess there is like a built-in, what is it, like the World War II kind of thing where you shoot down other planes.
There is. Yeah, it's actually, it's so difficult. It's not really immersive at all, but they did include that. And I want to say there was a dogfighting one, and I think, I can't remember if it was version 2, but one of the very early ones, they introduced the ability to drop a bomb, and you had a little bomb sight thing that you could look through. And, it was pretty basic.
I mean, it's very impressive, especially the first version that you could run on the 8086, all things considered. But, it's not something that you would... I mean, at this point in time, it only sort of represents the historical interest and not in any way an engrossing game.
Sure. The one last bit I want to mention about version 1.0 is when they were testing compatibility of IBM PC clones, of course, clones, you know, everywhere... It had to run Microsoft Flight Simulator 1.0 and one of the Lotus products. If it did those two things, it could go off the assembly line and say, you are, you know, fully IBM PC compatible. So
that's pretty funny.
It was kind of crazy. But yeah, really, as far as, you know, an actual kind of simulator that brings us out of wireframe graphics and anything approaching something that would, you know, would be... a little bit closer to what we remember with the other versions, really happened in 2.0. There you had, you actually had surfaces, you could see some exterior, some interior, you had the gauges. It was, in the PC world, it was CGA or monochrome, but, or I'm sorry, or, you know, two colors, but we were starting to see, a nod towards, you know, some type of attempt at realism, and that's the version that that I really remember encountering again more in the 8-bit world, but also in the PC world, where you could actually get a sense that you were flying. You know, you'd get the nice PC speaker sound, and you had a complicated set of controls. And really, with version 2, I remember the manual. Was just, it read like an encyclopedia. It was the amount of control you had even back then over very, very small aspects of you know, whether it was like, you know, the navigation lights on or off or all these things. It was really pretty incredible. So it kind of laid the groundwork for the for the later versions of the series. But 2 also has the big step forward. There was, they actually did allow you to fly across the whole United States if you wanted to. Now, you wouldn't get, you know, you would only get kind of major cities all kind of look the same. But technically speaking, going back to solo flight, where they actually had, you know, the real frequencies and this effective modeling of these ground-based stations, you could actually do one of these long flights or stop along the way. I don't recall exactly what aircraft you had to choose from in version 2, but this ability or this modeling of a large, you know, kind of area was possible. So that was the big feature upgrade in version 2 of Flight Simulator. And then, you know, really for my memory and experience, it really starts to take off and becomes a much, much more immersive and rich experience, starting with version 3. I mean, if you look at version 3, 3.0 versus any of the other ones, it's just a remarkable difference. And I'm probably remembering this through slightly rose-colored glasses, but certainly version 3 was EGA, and I don't actually remember if it was version 3 or version 4 that first introduced this high-res EGA, where it was 640 by 350.
16H mode. That I'm very fond of, but not that many games are made to support.
I remember chatting with Ben Chandler, Ben 304, about this. It just really, it made the color palette look it wasn't the EGA that we were all accustomed to. It was just a little bit sharper, and the colors, I think mainly because you're mostly dealing with exteriors and, you know, scenery and trees and grass and whatnot. It just really, it didn't matter what computer you were playing it on. If you had, you know, an EGA capable machine, it just really seemed to pop right out of the screen. It was kind of amazing, that, you know, now the instrument panel really, it really looked like you were inside a Cessna, and, you know, the runway was like the perfect kind of dark gray color, and, you know, the stripes on the runway were, you know, it just, everything really popped. And and this notably is the first simulator, first version of Flight Simulator, where you could view the outside of the airplane. So, you know, however many years later, now we're finally, I want to say we're on 88 or 89, you have that ability. And the other big part of it was kind of like you wanted to show off this great kind of, you know, high-res EGA world, you could do the windows. You know, you could have a window of, you could have, you know, 10 windows on the screen. It wouldn't run very fast, but, you know, you could have the, you know, the chase plane view or the control tower view, and you could just, you know, the possibilities were endless there. It was just really, so this notion of very high resolution, colorful graphics, yes, only 16 colors, but it kind of didn't matter. It's just this very, you know, primary color, bright palette was just really pleasing. And even looking back at screenshots, I just remember how magnificent that was, how much of a kind of step forward it was from the others. And really, even with some of the other flight sims from the time, which we'll get to, it really had a distinctive look and achieved in, you know, without going into VGA yet. I don't know that any other simulator really matched that. It just was a really, you know, a really great representation of, you know, inside and outside, and that's what I remember most. The version 3 introduced this where you could now add in scenery, specialized scenery, whether it was like an add-on or something like that, and you could now, of course, the prior version you could fly across the U.S., but now we're starting to see the integration of buildings and, you know, kind of a nod towards actually populating, you know, the terrain with somewhat realistic structures. So that started to creep in, and really kind of moving on to version 4 here, it really took off in Flight Sim, you know, or Microsoft Flight Simulator version 4, where, getting ahead of myself a little bit, but that was just a humongous influx of user-generated scenery and aircraft and everything else. So it was really somewhere in between there. I think there might have been a version 3.1. I'm pretty sure there was, but maybe a more of like a service pack type thing where, you know, you really started to see that come in. But version 4 was, graphically was pretty similar to version 3, same, kind of EGA, you said mode 16H there, but with 4, they added in they added in other air traffic. It was just on a static loop. So, I mean, you know, and it wasn't intelligent. You would just taxi right through another aircraft. But, this is something that always struck me. You know, you get this great flight simulator. You're going to do this flight and there's just lonely. There's nobody else out there. There's no other airplanes. There's no other air traffic. It's just, you know, roads, and it's just very, very lonely world. So, version 4, even though it was, maybe a, you know, it maybe not quite executed in a manner that we'd certainly be accustomed to today. It was nice if you put yourself right at O'Hare or a busy airport, you'd see a lot of aircraft going. So there was this, I wrote down the aircraft equivalent of NPCs, basically, in a very rudimentary form, and started to kind of populate the world more. The other big thing that I kind of hinted at was this was where the add-on market really, really took off and produced just a ton of great content for Flight Simulator 4. Did you use or did you play version 4 in your day?
No, I have not. Again, like I said, I guess I haven't said that, but I'm going to say it now. My experience with flight simulators is limited. Again, I always keep bringing up my background, but you know, most of the stuff that I got was lacked manuals.
Sure, sure.
And you know, being very young and with no manuals and no knowledge of English language, it was often very difficult for me to figure out.
Sure.
How to control a lot of simulators, especially some that are, you know, geared towards more like a realistic angle. I still managed to play a few just by like figuring out what the keys do eventually. But no, like MS Flight Simulators, I only played like the really, really early ones and played this really a stretch. I more like, you know, got to look at them and fail miserably. But that's pretty much my experience with MS Flight Simulators.
Okay, well, I got you. Well, you know what? That reminds me of something. With regard to, you know, of course, most of the time you'd want to play these or you want to use these with a joystick, but there was really no way around complicated keystrokes. And man, oh man, I can't remember exactly what the keystroke was, but just to get the parking brake released, it was impossible to figure out. If you didn't have a manual, if you didn't have a cheat sheet or something, it was a ridiculous keystroke. It was like control something bracket. Ugh. I could be remembering that wrong. Maybe I'm embellishing a little bit, but you know, you would think that they would make it a little bit easier to just, you know, all right, you're sitting there on the runway, maybe the engine's at idle, you know, or so on and so forth, and to go. But there were a couple of simulators. I don't know if I'm going to be able to remember which ones where you actually had to. You had a cold, dark airplane, and you had to power it up and turn the batteries on and everything else. And man, I mean, that's even in a you know, a two-seat Cessna or what should be a fairly simple aircraft, that's a pretty stepwise and somewhat complicated procedure to do that. So, gosh, you know, it was kind of hit or miss if I had manuals too. I did for some, I didn't for others. And, I mean, even being familiar with flight simulators with, you know, if you miss a step in the startup or whatever, it was tough. So I certainly understand that.
Yeah, yeah.
But this notion of add-ons and user-created content was, I wasn't a CompuServe member, but CompuServe at that time, kind of interesting to talk about from a historical standpoint, was just basically the hub for all this user-created content for flight simulators, or for Microsoft Flight Simulators specifically. So really from Flight Simulator 4 all the way through to the last DOS version, you know, I can't remember, you know, of course CompuServe shut down, but man, it was just a huge kind of supply source of all this. And this was really, you had, you know, BBSs and CompuServe and, you know, Genie and these sorts of things. But, you know, the web was still only text based or, you know, very, much in its formative stages. So, the way to create these add-ons was there were a couple of really, really great software products, which a couple of which I remember and had. And these were done by, I think most of them, by a company called Mallard. And the first one was called, Aircraft and Scenery Designer. So that this would run on Flight Sim 4, and it allowed you to, you could create, you know, scenery in almost like a SimCity type fashion, but you could kind of, you know, you had a kind of a limited, you know, CAD cam kind of capability where you could, you know, get a building and place it, and, you know, you could make your home airport or, you know, try to do your house or something like that, all on this large coordinate system that, that represented the, you know, wherever you were, whether it was, you know, the US or somewhere else. And, this is the first time we saw, an attempt at letting people design aircraft. And really, in that first version, it was more of a paint shop. You could take the, you know, their Cessna 182 or 172 and, you know, paint it purple or, you know, or, you know, some kind of goofy color. But, it did introduce this kind of way. If you were an engineer and you wanted to kind of model all the, you know, the frame of your aircraft, you could give it a try. There was another one called, the sound, graphics, and aircraft upgrade, which came a little bit later. This kind of coincided with the very, very early years of the sound card, where Flight Sim had been this, it had been, you know, PC speaker only, and boy, you'd get this, you know, the annoying stall warning horn, and, you know, the putt-putt-putt of the engine, and the, and that was, I want to say, did they get a squeal of the tires over the PC speaker? I can't remember, but it was very, very limited. You know, some beeps and boops for the instrumentation, but it allowed kind of the first nod towards digital sound, you know, using the Sound Blaster, Adlib, or whatnot, which was a welcome change. You got, you know, an actual jet engine sound and, you know, propeller sound and whatnot. But the biggest one that I remember is one of Mallard's later products called the Aircraft and Adventure Factory. And this was, again, for Flight Simulator 4, I believe it worked with later versions. I believe the adventure part did, but this was, so we're still in EGA, but this was a fully featured design studio with amazingly realistic and extremely difficult capabilities to actually, you want to get all the drawings and build your own aircraft. Well, you can do it. You want to build the SR-71 or the U-2 or one of these obscure kind of military aircraft. You could do it. It was, I remember thinking, I couldn't believe that they kind of allowed or, you know, kind of built in this capability when on most users it was really kind of way over people's heads. But, you know, certainly there were some engineers out there and some very, very intelligent people who did figure out how to do this, and this just enhanced the number of aircraft that eventually got kind of uploaded and circulated around. And the part that I remember, though, was this notion of creating an adventure. So for the first time, you could actually basically use a scripting language that was included and design almost like a mission or you know, put in events. And the language was basically, it was QBasic with, you know, just without the kind of rigid QBasic syntax. And this was a really, really, really neat thing. I chatted a little bit about this notion of flight simulators being very lonely and, you know, no one else out there, you're all by yourself. Well, this allowed for really kind of just immersive creation of an event. So, and you could intersperse sound files. You could actually show, it had to be in PCX format, I think, but you could show, like, you know, congratulations, you accomplished this, you know, you landed at this airport in, you know, in a record amount of time, and show like a picture or a ribbon or something like that. But the event, kind of the event-driven structure of it was such that you could make something pretty complicated, and it was really, people really figured out kind of really interesting things to do and pushed the envelope of maybe even what Mallard thought. I remember just being very excited at the fact that you could simulate a more realistic air traffic control model. Of course, it wouldn't be perfect, but you could build in, you know, if, you know, user is flying, this heading is flying north and is at this altitude, play this WAV file or VOC file or whatever it is. And I remember I actually, I said, oh, this is great. So I had my terrible Sound Blaster microphone, Creative Labs microphone, and I got my dad. I said, hey, Dad, I said, you got to record, you know, I'm going to write this stuff down. You know, go ahead and read these things, and I'll use this, and this will be an adventure. We'll go from, you know, from Chicago to here, and you'll be the voice of air traffic control. And you could actually, you know, in the kind of event-driven way, you could say, you know, if you strayed on your heading, if you were supposed to be flying, say, a south heading, and you were, you know, 10 degrees off or 20 degrees off, you could say, oh, all right, you know, play this other sound and say, you know, Cessna 354, you know, turn back or, you know, correct your heading or whatever. So it was, again, it was a very one-dimensional kind of nod towards air traffic control, but the capability of the system was such that we had never seen anything like this before. And people came up with all sorts of things, whether from, you know, kind of simulating running an airline to contests and competitions and all sorts of stuff. So the Aircraft and Adventure Factory, I remember very fondly for the adventure part of it. And you did get to a point where, I mean, we're still talking, I think, in the maybe 286 days or maybe a very, very rudimentary 386 SX or something. I don't even think we were there yet. So it's... you did get to the point where if you loaded up with too many events, it would kind of slow down, or it would kind of, you know, it wasn't, it didn't have unlimited potential. But for what it was, it really did well. So that was the really exciting part of Flight Simulator 4. The next two versions are pretty important and remembered fondly by me and many. So we finally come to Flight Simulator 5. And this was the big one. This was the first texture-based version of Microsoft Flight Simulator. So we're out of VGA. We're now into, kind of low-res VGA, 320 by 200 by 256. And you load it up, and immediately you're just greeted by this gorgeous instrument panel of the Cessna and looking down Migs Field in Chicago. And the runway looks like a real runway. You can see the city in the distance. You can see the Sears Tower and all these buildings, and it just looks so amazing and so different from really most every other flight simulator that I remember. Actually, this is funny. I remember a beta actually leaked out of Microsoft, and it made the circulation on various places that was discussed last time in the podcast. And the only thing that was in the beta was Chicago. So it was only one of the kind of major cities, but it was enough to whet everybody's appetite. And we said, man, this is really, my friends and I and whoever else said, we're going to have to get this when this comes out, because this looks like, like real life for the first time. Certainly the other versions were very neat to look at, but you still, even looking at high-res EGA, you really had the sense, okay, this is, a road doesn't really look like this, or, while the greens are really, really pretty and the sky is kind of a uniform blue, you really know. The simulator. Flight Simulator 5 was this first time that, certainly you had more colors, but the textures and the instrument panel was digitized. It really looked kind of amazing. And, there were some simulators out there that had done this. We'll mention it when I get to the rest of them here, but like A-10 Tank Killer is a good example. They, that was, Dynamics, and that was a couple years before. So, they had digitized the important kind of pieces of an A-10 cockpit, and it looked great, but the outside, the actual simulator world was still more rudimentary. So that was actually smart. They got this, okay, you're immersed in this realism of, wow, the cockpit looks just great, but the outside of it was not texture based; it was still polygon based. So, still quite good. But Flight Simulator 5, which I want to say was right around 93, really kind of brought it all together. And of course, at that point, you had 386 machines. You had certain machines with maybe some coprocessor capability, and VGA had kind of, whether it was adventure games or other games or first person shooters, kind of come into to where it was kind of becoming more
the norm.
The fact that Flight Simulator 5 was texture-based, there were a lot of other technological things, but that's really the big one. And I'm pretty sure that, you could climb up really, really high, and if you looked down at Chicago from, say, 10,000 feet, it just looked incredible. You're like, oh, that's really how it looks. So I couldn't actually find any data on this, but I'm pretty sure they at least consulted satellite imagery to kind of stratify the views as you got higher in altitude. And of course, when you got close, it was pretty jaggy. I mean, this was very, very kind of early on textures. They were great, but certainly there was a lot of room for improvement, and it certainly wasn't perfect. But I also remember version 5 and 5.1, if you had a slow machine, you had to crank all the detail down. I mean, it was, you could get a glimpse at maybe, oh, this is what I could get if it would look like this if I had a the fastest 386 out there, maybe a 386-33 or something. But for most of it, it was, all right, if you wanted to actually use it and fly around, you had to crank the detail way down. So that was kind of an interesting one. Flight Simulator 5, also the last one to come on disc exclusively. I can't remember how many floppies, but it was quite a few. And then version 5.1, which is the last DOS version of Flight Simulator, I still say one of the best flight simulators of all time. It came on CD-ROM, or at least it had I think it was maybe there was a floppy option, but it was available on CD-ROM, and this built on everything in version 5 and just expanded it out. People had kind of figured out now how to deal with the fact that all of their add-ons, all of their scenery files from the prior versions were basically incompatible. They would have looked just ridiculous, you know, vector based or, you know, wireframe based or whatever. Now moving to textures, everything had to be redone. So 5.1 saw the advent of, you know, just mountains of, you know, additional scenery and aircraft and kind of add-on third-party products. The best one, or one of the better ones, was from a French company called Airport, where you could, you know, load in this, you know, purchase the add-on, install it, and you had actual, you know, good, solid, realistic kind of airport modeling for, I think it was 200 or 250 airports around the world. So from Amsterdam to Moscow to Paris to Seattle, you know, certainly the major cities and everything in between, you had this, you could actually really, really enhance the actual airport setting, which was great. And 5.1 really still, it still stands up. It's still just a blast to get in and play. You can go, you know, pretty much anywhere in the U.S., you know, around the world. You can go to Australia, you know, pick a small airport, large airport, it'll be in there. And then if you combined it with, you know, the various large number of offerings of add-ons, you could really get yourself something pretty immersive. 5.1 also had some very specific aircraft add-ons that really, really, really pushed the envelope of realism. I want to say there was it was a 747 add-on. I can't remember the company, but we started to see these standalone products where it was just one airplane, but it was modeled in such a realistic way. Maybe it came with like a standard like Boeing flight manual, or, you know, almost but not quite something like that, and that was. That was kind of there. And then, yeah, there was more support for other peripherals, so rudder pedals and, you know, the kind of, you know, throttles and all this sort of thing. So this kind of idea of building, you know, a machine and really accomplishing, you know, a very, very kind of hardware-based simulator was certainly much more possible with 5.1. And that was 5.1 was probably the version that that I probably interacted with the most from a DOS standpoint. And of course the series went on for quite a while after that into Windows. After, you know, basically it was Flight Simulator for Windows 95, pretty much a straight port of 5.1 just over to Windows. They added a couple of things, but really it didn't change all that much. And then certainly it went through you know, several iterations and, you know, some famous versions up into the Windows realm. But 5.1 was really, you know, it was stable, you know, good graphics, sound. It kind of embraced the technology that was present and really did it very well. You could do pretty much anything you wanted to do, in the realm of a civilian simulator in 5.1. And it's, like I said, one I certainly remember very fondly. Oh, the other thing, the other kind of memory that I have is this notion of, you know, flying at night. Always been fascinating to me, even when I was a little kid. But and it actually started in version 5. But so you load it up, you get into the Cessna or the Learjet or whatever, and the nighttime lighting of the instrument panel is just remarkable. It's this red. It looks like something you'd see in a, you know, 1,000 feet down in a submarine. It's this red lighting and this, you know, it's kind of dim and it just looks great. And having taught people and flown some of the earlier model Cessnas, you know, that is exactly how the lighting looks. It's just basically a red overhead light. And it, there, you know, some of the old fashioned instruments have a little bit of a kind of luminous element in them that when the red light hits it, they kind of, you know, kind of lights up. And it's almost maybe a little spooky, but it just they really nailed the you know, the night, you know, the night kind of instrument panel. I remember I would turn off all the lights and just have the, you know, the glow of like the caps lock, number lock, and then nice. You know, the screen on, and it was just, oh man, it was great. So the airport lighting, it's, you know, it's just something very satisfying about that, to where, you know, going back to solo flight where you just had a runway, there were no airport lights. I mean, there wasn't enough detail, you know, not enough pixels on the screen to, or enough, you know, bytes left in, you know, in the, in whatever the memory registers were to kind of push that and do that effectively, where now, you know, you could actually, you were rewarded with, all right, if I come out at the right spot and I've flown the correct airspeed and heading and such and so on and so forth, you know, now I'm going to see this great kind of series of runway lights leading me in, and or approach lights leading me in, and, you know, seeing the taxiway lights were blue, and it was just this really, you know, it was really very immersive. And that's, you know, that's when, you know, I kind of really felt like, all right, this is, you know, we're really getting to where real life is going to be, you know, kind of easier to model. And certainly Flight Simulator 5 and 5.1 were, you know, did that quite well. But, wow. So that's Flight Simulator. That's talked for a lot longer than I thought about. Kind of an interesting thing, I guess, from a personal standpoint. I'd love to know why Bruce Sartwick in version 1 chose to start things off at Migs Field. I'm actually from the Chicago area. Migs Field is this iconic airport that actually got closed. That's a story for another podcast. You can look it up. It's kind of a sad story, actually. But it kind of had this, it lived on and was, you know, people who wouldn't be familiar with aviation at all, if they had loaded up and played or used, you know, any version of Flight Simulator, it always starts you off at Migs Field. It was just kind of a thing. And I remember they, you know, when it finally got closed, they took it out, and it was a really big deal. They, you know, it's called Northerly Island now, and there's no more airport there. It's kind of a, like I said, kind of a sad story. But you know, I always wondered, did Bruce Sartwick, I think, who was from like downstate, or you know, maybe he was somewhat affiliated with the University of Illinois or went to school there in kind of central rural Illinois, did he, you know, fly in and out of Migs Field and just enjoyed it or whatnot and said, I'm going to put this in the game? But it became like a 14, 15, 20 year thing where that was where you started off. And, I actually was lucky enough to have the good fortune to fly an airplane for a guy who went into Migs Field quite a bit. So I've been there probably 50 times. It was in between closures. They closed it once, reopened it, and then they finally bulldozed it in the middle of the night, and it was no more. But, you know, short runway right on Lake Michigan, great view of the skyline. So it's really, I mean, I guess from a, you know, to kind of grab your attention, it makes sense to set things there, but, it was just, you know, it was really neat. I'd love to, know that kind of the design story behind, or the, you know, the tidbit to where they said, all right, we're going to put it at Migs, and then they continued to do that. So even when in very early versions, when you didn't have, really very much even modeled outside, that was something that people could readily identify. So that was pretty neat. But yeah, so there's Flight Simulator. You know what? I really only have one other civilian sim, and then we can get into the other ones. It's kind of in the later years, but it's every bit as good as Microsoft Flight Simulator, and really even that much more. And you know what I'm talking about. Of course, it's Flight Unlimited.
I got to chime in here for a little bit before you take over. Not on any technical aspects or anything, but to me, this is kind of interesting for several reasons. First of all, it's developed by Looking Glass Studios, but it's also published by Looking Glass. It's one of the three products of their own that they published. The other two being Terra Nova and that golf game that I don't remember the title of. That's not for DOS. But yeah, Flight Unlimited, developed and published by Looking Glass. And one big detail which we recently discussed on Twitter was that it was built to function with like one specific virtual reality headset,
right?
To the point where the in-game menu is like a 3D room that you look around in.
Yeah, and that's great, because this really brings to kind of this topic of immersion, which, you know, despite all the technological advancements and all the really kind of great things that the other simulators are able to do, at the, you know, you were still, even with turning the lights off and whatever, you're still looking at a 14-inch monitor with, you know, an early 90s era machine,
right?
You know, maybe a CH flight stick, or maybe something a little more, you know, a little niftier or slightly more realistic. And this, the fact that they were able to embrace this VR technology, and really integrate it into the game to where it was a big payoff if you had one of these to use it. I never did.
No, neither did I.
You know, it was pricey, but clearly, you know, Looking Glass thought that this was going to be this is an emerging technology, and it would be, you know, they clearly spent a lot of time integrating it, and unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people really got to use it.
I don't think many people have.
Yeah, even though they didn't, that didn't see kind of widespread use. Flight Unlimited was great for a lot of reasons, and certainly the physics model is something we'll chat about in just a second here. But
well, I was actually about to say that, like, it was a huge marketing point of it is is a super ultra realistic physics model.
Absolutely, and really the I don't know if simulators have done it since then, but at the time was the only one to actually use kind of particle based physics to determine the characteristics of how the plane kind of moved through space and reacted. So if you applied, you know, too much force, the plane would break up. And this was, again, it seems like, well, wouldn't all of these flight simulators do that? But it was, you know, it was kind of at a time where we're talking 46s now, and you know, floating point capability, and you know, somewhat even, you know, 640 by 480, or even, you know, VGA and SVGA displays, to where you know, it was able to, you were able to actually do this, and it really was just it just felt very, very realistic. It felt, you know, much more realistic even than Microsoft Flight Simulator or any of the other ones, just, you know, because of that. But I'm glad you mentioned the virtual reality part of it, because I think an often overlooked component of Flight Unlimited, certainly the flight model was great, the graphics were really well done, you know, you could fly this, you know, gorgeous red biplane and turn on the smoke and do a loop and just, you know, see yourself flying through the sky, which is, it was really, you know, quite brilliant. But the fact that you started in this room at, like, an FBO, which stands for a fixed base operator, you know, an airport that's not a large airport like JFK or O'Hare or something, has these smaller kind of, you know, places where, you know, maybe airplanes are in hangars and whatnot, but kind of a central point where you can, you know, kind of take out the map or, you know, do kind of the activities you have to do before you actually get in the airplane, plan out your flight, pick up the phone and call in your flight plan, maybe have a cup of coffee, whatever. And they actually modeled that, and it was very immersive. So the fact that you start in this fixed space, you know, kind of this FBO, this fixed base operation, mm-hmm. was brilliant. And it maybe really speaks to me more, because, you know, that was my life for a while, whether it was teaching people how to fly or learning to fly myself, you know, in one of those locations. But it really added this. And this is something, you know, the subject of another podcast, but it's so great. And I've heard the Blue Cup Tools gentleman talk about this quite a bit, where if you certainly don't want to do mundane activities, but it's very rewarding to play a game or, you know, or a simulator where some of the kind of everyday activities are modeled in such a way that it's rewarding. So to go through the extra steps of, oh, I need to, you know, take out the map and take a look at it, or, you know, maybe I just click on the phone or whatever and says, would you like to file your flight plan? Yes, I'm just, you know, using examples here. But just even the look of, maybe you can see your airplane out the window and, you know, you go through the door and out. And Flight Unlimited was not the only game or simulator to do this. This was certainly popular in the, you know, in the Origin titles and some other ones, but it was just an added layer that that really, really stood out. It was probably you know, it really has very little bearing on the actual gameplay, but it really, that attention to detail, I really, really appreciate it. And I guess that's probably because I actually did kind of live that, but they were really the only ones to do that in that kind of a detailed sense. And Flight Unlimited was just, I mean, gosh, it was, as far as civilian sims go, you know, hard to beat. Just, you know, several kind of locations, I think I want to say there were five or six, it might be more than that, where they concentrated on, okay, we're not going to model the entire U.S. in breathtaking detail, but what we do is going to be done really well, and they're going to be very aesthetically pleasing locations. So I think there's like an Arizona, Vermont, and a few other ones where, you know, these are really kind of interesting color palettes and very terrain rich kind of environments. And they, it's one of my all-time favorite simulators. It took a while to where I think I was in between upgrades and, you know, whether it's like a 4633 to a 4650 or 66, I can't remember exactly, but maybe it was even into the first Pentiums, I don't recall, but the ability to run Flight Unlimited, you know, with a decent frame rate was one of the driving forces behind, all right, you know, time to, you know, get the components and build a new computer, because it was really it was somewhat punishing. It was not kind to kind of systems that lacked some power. But if you could get it running, you know, smoothly, it was very rewarding. Acrobatics in particular. I mean, of course, it was great. But I want to say if it was in the manual or if it was just, you know, you could really do a lot of kind of complicated acrobatic maneuvers. And if you exceeded something, if you pulled too many G's, I mean, the plane would just, it would break up in a very realistic fashion. The wings would fold or, you know, it was really, you know, I feel like I talked about Flight Simulator for so long. I'm kind of not really giving Flight Unlimited its due, but it was a revolutionary product. And, I think it's worth mentioning too, the one of the lead programmers, or was he the like project leader, but that gentleman went on to be kind of a primary person on the Xbox. Do you remember anything about that?
Yes, I do. I unfortunately do not remember the name, but I have, when I was preparing for this, I've read this.
I want to say it might be like Seamus Beeson. I could be completely making that up. Something like that. Anyway, he was, you know, it was just a great, kind of amazing flight model, and he was, of course, went on to, you know, to a lot of success in the you know, kind of the first in Xbox and Microsoft and whatnot. But Flight Unlimited was really a great one, and of course there were sequels, but those are all most definitely not DOS, so we'll have to leave it at
and not as good from what I read.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. There's something about just the. Like I said, just kind of the quaint just nature of starting with how the FBO was modeled to flying. It just really works. It really, really did well. So I think that's it for civilian sims as far as I can see. So we've got quite a few military ones here. But before I get started, I think it's worth talking about, you know, I've got World War One and Two, and then you know, kind of into the jet age and kind of the modern day. But one of the big differences between, you know, civilian and military simulators is, you know, the military ones really, there's generally a little bit more story, whether it's, you know, straight out of historical context or a kind of a made-up conflict or something. They tend to be rooted in, you know, in much more, you know, in events that actually occurred. So already I feel like military simulators have this built-in, you can kind of jump in and kind of the immersive part of it. It's a lot easier to do that than to just get in a very kind of complicated civilian sim. And a lot of times, especially dealing with combat, some of the actual realism elements have been scaled down quite a bit. Certainly not everywhere, but, you know, to allow for, you know, so I guess the point is, you know, the military sims, they tend to range from very, very complicated, very difficult, you know, almost impossible to fly or accomplish your goal to the kind of almost more kind of video gamey and everything in between. And I think it's worth mentioning that I found, you know, different titles from all over the spectrum to be very enjoyable for different reasons. But I guess it kind of leads right into perhaps it's so hard to pick a favorite, but certainly in the non-jet context, Red Baron is just. Yes. That's such a good game.
That's most and people's go-to.
So Red Baron, you know, by Dynamics. Mm-hmm. This was, I want to say, had they been acquired by Sierra? I think they'd had.
They have, yes.
So A-10 Tank Killer, at least A-10 Tank Killer 1, was pre-Sierra acquisition. And that is also worth chatting about. We'll get to that. But, of course, it used the three-space model that was used in, you know, Stellar 7 and Nova 9 and, you know, the lot of the Dynamics products at that time. So post Sierra acquisition, and really, I can't talk about Red Baron without first talking about the box. This was a game that, I mean, man, you know, big box games in the early 90s, at least in where I lived, they were expensive. I mean, $59.95, and, you know, there was really no way to beat that. Maybe you could, you know, go to a non-software store and maybe find it, you know, for a little bit less than that. But especially for a, you know, this is 1990, 1991, so, you know, I don't know, I'm 12, 13 years old, and that was, you know, it took a long time, a lot of lawns mowed to save up for one of these if it wasn't Christmas time or whatever. But I remember thinking, well, if I'm going to spend $60, this Red Baron, this is such a great, you got so much. The box art was just great. This is heavy, you know, you get it off the shelf and it's just, it's got so much in there. It's got, you know, several floppy disks and the manual and the pack-in stuff. I wish I still had it. Just trying to economize space about, you know, about 3 years ago, I chucked all my boxes. Aww. I saved the manual floppies, but my regret in that. I wish I'd at least hung on to a few of the Sierra titles or like this. But man, you know, it was just really, really just, they couldn't fit anything else in there between the, you know, the cheat sheet and this great manual. And they had these maps. The maps were actually, like, I don't know if they were real parchment, but it sure looked like it. This faux kind of parchment paper. It crinkled and it had all the, you had a map of, you know, France and, the front and everything else. And it was just really, they did a really, really great job. I'm sure they spent a fortune on packaging and art and everything. It just was really great. So that's kind of something I wanted to mention, even though it's really probably not that important. But, Red Baron was just, kind of a perfect blend of, you know, all the aspects of these very, very first aircraft, you know, biplanes and triplanes and, you know, very rudimentary, you know, gun sights, and, was really kind of when a lot of the, you know, the, kind of the method of dogfighting and energy management and all these things that are really still taught today, the basics of air combat were all figured out in this, you know, in this era, you know, so, you know, post Wright brothers, but, you know, the late 1910s into, you know, kind of after that. So the great thing I remember about Red Baron was if it had just been a pure flight simulator of, you know, you've got, you know, say 20, you know, aircraft to choose from the very first, monoplane to, you know, the famous Sopwith Camel and then the, you know, the Fokker triplane and everything in between, that probably would have been enough. It would have been, you know, nothing that anyone had ever done in that way. And if you just said, okay, we're going to model these, you know, whatever it is, dozen or 15 airplanes, we're going to do them really well, that probably would have sold games or sold, you know, done okay. But the great thing was you had this great kind of campaign mode, this story that was tied directly to, you know, kind of the events of World War One, and you could play either side, and in a very, you know, very much in a kind of almost an adventure game or a non-simulator kind of game style, you had the kind of the perfect blend of this. And certainly you would encounter famous aces, or, you know, you'd be asked to join the squadron of, you know, let's say, you know, Richthofen or some of the others, and you would, you know, accrue kind of medals and accomplishments. And I remember you'd really get invested. They had these great cutscenes of, you know, kind of these sepia-toned photos and text and music that would play, and you could get, it was really engaging. And it's one of the things that I think about with games now is everything is so kind of achievement-driven. And man, they had this figured out in, you know, 1990. Man, you've got a medal or some, you know, shot down a lot of airplanes or, you know, kind of escorted bombers or whatever it was in such a way. You got this great, oh, I've never seen the Flying Cross or, you know, something like that. It was just, it was really rewarding. So, that's the first kind of simulator where I remember kind of the melding of those two concepts. And it was done really well. You know, historically, I can't speak to how accurate it was, but it really seemed like all the research that was poured in, that, you know, they tried to, what they could kind of realistically model, they did, and they did it well. I mean, dogfighting was just a lot of fun. You know, you could, that was another thing. You'd get shot down, and it was kind of flip a coin if you would, you know, you'd get captured, And then somebody, you know, you'd end up, you know, in France or somewhere else, and you'd, you know, you'd lose some time, but then, you know, a year would go by and you'd be able to kind of rejoin the campaign and try to work your way back up. And, it would show you, it'd show you a picture of yourself and you'd age, you know, your beard gets longer and all. It was just, it was really, you know, there were a lot of nods to kind of this immersive gameplay that, which is fantastic. You know, you could go after zeppelins. I don't think really you'd really had the opportunity to do that in any of these other simulators. And it was just great. The frame rate was good. The flight modeling was good. If you cranked the realism up, your guns would jam. You know, you if you tried to pull excessive maneuvers, you would kind of red out. You know, positive and negative G's. And the sun would kind of light up the. You know, if you're going right into the sun, you really couldn't see anything. So. If you played it on, you know, difficult or you know, kind of fully with the realism turned up, it was great. Just a really great platform, you know, very well coded, very well designed, and even down to the menus and the music, it was all just really, really well put together. So Red Baron is, and I actually didn't know that you know, there were subsequent like high resolution updates, and probably in the Windows era, but I never played anything other than the original one in, you know, 320x200.
Right.
And, you know, I guess I hear the other versions are great, but I know
the sequel is largely, you know, the same game, just slightly updated, but it is for Windows.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's, yeah. And honestly,
however, graphically, I'd like to point out that it's one of those games because it came so early in the VGA era. It was one of those games where you, if you didn't have a VGA adapter, you could actually, you would buy the EGA only version.
That's right.
Was also available as EGA only product, which you could, I think, then subsequently upgrade to VGA if you would like mail in something. But yeah, that's one of those games that, you know, available separately for different adapters.
That's great. I did not. We had EGA by that time in the household, so I actually didn't ever play the EGA version. But that's I remember the that's right. I think if you mailed in your discs and I think $4.99 or something, the same way I think for replacement floppies, but they'd send it back to you. So that that's right. I'll have to look for the a couple of EGA screenshots. I'll bet it was. Still pretty good, but
yeah, of course. But it's like 1990. I mean, and you know, it helps that it's my favorite type of sort of 3D is actually just flat shaded polygons. So, like Microsoft Flight Simulator proved, you can do a lot in flat shaded EGA if you really try.
Sure.
So there's that. But personally, I really like Red Baron. I did not ever play it on realism like all the way up. But I guess with an easy, it was simple enough for me to figure out and play, and it was fun. It's a fun game to play. Just the way the campaigns are structured, and the way you can just dive immediately into a dogfight, like in the middle of a dogfight, like if you feel it. Well, that's basically the core of the game. And
sure.
You know, you could record your missions and play back a little piece with like external cameras and stuff like that. It was all very, very nice for a game that's also, you know, it's 1990. That was quite a long time ago. And considering how far we went from like, you know, 85 to 1990, just in 5 years, the leap is gigantic. And I'd say like Red Baron is legitimately one of the best DOS games of all time.
Oh, I totally agree. And that's something that, at least talking about the VGA version of it, I feel like the Sierra and Dynamics titles, so 89, 1990, are such a great showcase for VGA. Certainly we can squabble over, you know, at least in the adventure games, how good they were or if they were flawed or whatever, but just visually, Red Baron and, you know, and some of the, you know, the other games that came out, you know, right around there are just, I think how could you walk into a computer store or see a magazine or something and see that and think, if I don't have a VGA adapter, how do you not want one after seeing that? So I just, you know, and Red Baron really, the, you know, the aircraft, for flat shaded polygons, they really looked good.
So all those neat details, like, you know, they all had shadows on the ground and stuff like that. It was very impressive.
And I don't, it certainly wasn't the first one, but, a lot of sound going on in that game, whether it was, mm-hmm. The menu music, or, you know, all the effects of the engine and the pitch changing as, you know, you accelerated, decelerated, and gunshots and everything else and hits. And so a lot of, kind of heavy use of granted basic, but heavy use of sound to where, you know, there's a sound event going pretty much the whole time, certainly the whole time you're playing, and through most of the rest of it too. So that was that's worth noting too. And honestly, the PC speaker sound wasn't terrible, but it was they did a pretty good job in the very early stages of people starting to get ad libs and sound blasters and whatnot. So it was definitely, I guess, in an era where, you know, not all games supported, you know, or had kind of sound card support built in. I guess, yeah, in 1990, I guess it was pretty common, but maybe the couple years before it was hit or miss. But yeah, Red Baronage, I can't say enough about it. I was really kind of sad to see that Kickstarter didn't fund. But I'm hopeful they will kind of make the game anyway, or not kind of give up on it. Damon Sly, that's the guy's name, the lead guy for that one with Dynamics. Just a great, great title. And that kind of leads right into
the other ones. Dynamics had a fine tradition of making good games.
Absolutely. Certainly their simulations were great, and really kind of a crown jewel of, you know, I put them and Cocktail Vision, you know, right up there, as far as, you know, before Sierra went kind of nuts and following in the EA footsteps, which is acquiring everybody, when it was really, you know, kind of just a few studios or a few kind of companies that all had their unique kind of style. Dynamics was really, really, really good. Moving on to Aces, the Aces series, Aces of the Pacific, Aces over Europe. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say a whole bunch about these two, because the great things about Red Baron really do translate.
In a way, they're, I guess, spiritual sequels.
Yeah.
To Red Baron, to the point where, you know, menus look the same, and they didn't really, they sort of adopt the philosophy of why fix what's not broken. So, and they just sort of put that engine and that technology and just everything else into a different era and different scenarios, and they just go from there. I mean, and they, I guess, graphics get slightly better.
Yep.
In reality, just kind of mostly the same good game.
Yeah, it's funny.
Which one do you like more out of the two?
You know what? I've got to
go with the Pacific, right? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. No? It's funny because that was another box that I purchased. I don't know if it was a reward for good grades or something. So I think that was actually a gift or some holiday or something. But, you know, kind of same thing, same enormous box, great pack-ins, you know, everything else. The funny thing is, Ace of the Pacific, Ace Over Europe, just great games, very much in the spirit of Red Baron. But honestly, I didn't like either one quite as much as Red Baron.
Right.
There was an aspect of the campaign mode in particular. It just wasn't as immersive. I was thinking about this before the podcast, and certainly you had really, you know, you were talking about, you know, aircraft carriers and these really great looking airplanes. Yeah, they even found a way to, you know, to kind of not really straight up texture them, but I remember the wings and the insignia just looked, you know, even a little more updated, a little better, in some cases a lot better than the surfaces or the planes in Red Baron. But there was just a little something missing where the World War I campaign was so tightly integrated. And maybe it's because, I don't know, it's a larger game, maybe a little bit more ambitious, but there was just a little something that was lost, and it's still a heck of a lot of fun to play, and very enjoyable. Definitely, you know, great, great games. But something about Red Baron, they did it just a little better.
Right. So I agree.
It was still very, very good, but not quite the really immersive start to finish experience that I would say was so enjoyable about Red Baron. So I think talking about 3Space, I think whatever iteration or technology, I think it was like 3Space 2.0 or something. It was an upgraded but still kind of the same graphics engine as Red Baron, just tweaked a little bit or optimized or whatever the case was. All right, so next up, I've got the LucasArts Sims. So their Finest Hour, Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe, what is it? There's one more in there. I want to mention these because I think they're important, but in all honesty, I did not play these very much.
I haven't played them either. I was about to ask you, like, do they build on the sort of like X-Wing TIE Fighter kind of things? Or
you're an intelligent man. That's the only reason I even wrote these down, because I want to say Lawrence Holland and some of the LucasArts folks who were, you know, absolutely integral to the later X-Wing and TIE Fighter projects. The modeling and some of the early engine stuff all came from these flight simulators.
Well, it would only make sense. So, right. Yeah, that's what I figured. I've seen one of them. I think it was Secret Weapons.
Yeah. It's actually, I've played the most, and that's still just not very much. But yeah, definitely. I think that might have been the one that was most closely linked to X-Wing. So, and these are decent sims. I don't think they're nearly as immersive, certainly, as Red Baron, or even, you know, Aces or some of the other ones. But and looking at some videos and kind of remembering back, you know, loading up X-Wing, you do see some pretty stark similarities to how, you know, the combat and the kind of the mechanics are handled. Mm-hmm. But you know, they're certainly enjoyable, but they didn't leave enough of an impression where I said, "Man, I've gotta buy this game. I've gotta get this game somehow and really play it." And that's not meant to be any type of judgment. It's just for me personally, that was Red Baron and Aces kind of filled that void. And I did want to mention that the LucasArts, because they really didn't do. You know, they did that series of flight simulators. That was kind of it, and then of course it was on to, the Star Wars kind of titles, and you know, and of course adventure games and everything else. But you know, because X-Wing was such a great kind of entry in kind of the Star Wars or kind of space simulator genre, I just wanted to mention those because a lot of the legwork was done, you know, for X-Wing with those. But otherwise. Personally speaking, they were not ones that I played often. And then, so really, the last World War II one that I have in the list here is kind of a late entry, kind of the last one of the last MicroProse DOS simulators, and that's B-17 Flying Fortress.
Right. Yeah, I have not personally played that, but. I was sort of like looking stuff up while preparing for this, and two things that like almost immediately catch my eye. And of course, this is like, first of all, it looks great. Yeah. Like all the 3D landscape and everything just looks amazingly detailed, for the kind of technology. But of course, the biggest one that came was a surprise to me when I saw that is the, crew management, aspect of it.
Yeah, I won't talk for too long about this one because I think we're into, and this is like 94, maybe early 95. But, you know, the B-17 in kind of general aviation history is regarded as just a kind of an engineering and technological and design kind of miracle, where it's this large lumbering airplane that flies slow and, you know, unpressurized and all this, you know, kind of so on and so forth. But the plane could take such an enormous amount of damage and continue to fly, and it did all these really dangerous, really kind of just unbelievable missions, whether it was, you know, daylight bombing or, you know, all these various kind of, you know, things that are really regarded positively as you look back in history. And it's an ambitious project, but one that I think Microsoft did very well, to where, once again, if you would just say pilot, co-pilot, you know, the more typical, you know, fly looking out the front, and maybe you can, you know, look through the side windows, maybe even, you know, go to the tail turret or something. If that was it, again, probably would have been an okay sim and would have, you know, reviewed relatively well. But the fact that they really, a big part of the simulator of the game is all the various different positions. And you said it, you know, to be able to really manage your crew and jump in to anyone's position. You want to be the, you know, the navigator, you go to that seat and it's almost like, you know, one step short of like walking through the airplane and just kind of going front to back. And that was a really, they did very well. The graphics are quite good. Very, very, you know, impressively modeled on the inside. You know, the flight characteristics, it feels like you're flying a, you know, a heavy aircraft. And this was a good one. I want to say the, you know, I kind of had to look at the chronology of MicroProse to see when, you know, and they continued, you know, to do simulators for a couple of years after this, but this was definitely one of their better ones. I think the, in all of the attention that was paid to the ability to man all the different crew stations, it's maybe a little lacking in kind of overall structure or gameplay, but from a realism or kind of historical standpoint, I feel like they really nailed it. I feel like this would actually hold up pretty well if you could, you know, if you could run this in DOSBox or, you know, or if someone were to, you know, to upgrade it to, you know, some sort of a higher resolution. I feel like it would probably stand on its own pretty well. I was hoping to be able to do that. I didn't get a chance to do it before the podcast, but it's definitely a good one and very unique in this, you know, I keep coming back to immersion and how kind of important and, kind of rare that is. And this is a game that really does it well. And it's definitely worth checking out, or giving a try. And, you know, the typical structure of missions and, you know, and briefings and whatnot. But it's definitely, you know, to actually be able to jump in and look through the bomb site and, you know, is a really kind of a neat thing. So this was one that, like I said, it was kind of, I kind of got this feeling it reviewed well. It was, you know, I think it sold okay, but it seemed to kind of be the beginning of the downturn of at least maybe, you know, non-jet flight simulators to where it just didn't really take off. It didn't, if it had been released maybe a couple years before, I kind of feel like it would have gotten kind of solidified a larger place in history, but it just kind of was, it seemed like it was released at the wrong time. It didn't really catch on, but it's a shame because it really is a well done simulator.
All right. Yeah. I will be checking it out in the future because it looks really, really interesting.
Nice. All right. Well, that is certainly by no means a cult. I'm sorry. I have to mention one other one, just because a little bit of a back and forth with somebody about this one. That it's not on the list, but one that I think bears mentioning is Heroes of the 357th, which was an EA game from I believe 1992. Mm. And I'll just say just a little bit about it. But this is a game where you could fly a couple of different versions of the very, very famous P-51 Mustang, which is kind of, if the B-17 is the kind of most famous and, or one of the most famous kind of, military bombers, the P-51 is that in the fighter slash, kind of escort realm. Flew really fast, very, very, you know, very, very sharp looking, fast, you know, a lot of guns, a lot of everything, a lot of airplane, and was kind of the crown jewel of the you know, kind of the early to late or to mid 40s fleet of at least of U.S. aircraft. A lot of the really famous folks that went on to great things in aviation flew them. Chuck Yeager flew a B-51 in for a while, and so on and so forth. And they're still, you know, the air show performers will still fly them around. You actually still have people who have a lot of private owners of P-51s that they've restored and whatnot. But I just want to touch on Heroes of the 357 briefly because the mission briefings were really well done. Honestly, the game itself it kind of seemed a little bit thrown together. The graphics, 1992, 93, they were a little dated. It was kind of straight polygon stuff, but it didn't look nearly as good as some of the, you know, the Dynamics titles. It was, much more in the, you know, kind of late 80s EA you know, kind of very bland palette, you know, kind of simple structure aircraft. But you know, it was the kind of the what kind of bound it together was the attention to specific mission objectives and outcomes and the briefings. And that actually, if you could kind of look past the lack of kind of pretty visuals in the actual flying, the flight model was pretty good. Maybe a little bit more arcade-like than maybe a, you know, a purist would want, but certainly, you know, flyable and enjoyable. And the, you know, there was almost kind of a strategy or, you know, just a really, really well thought out kind of reasoning behind the mission structure that was lacking in some of the other games. Certainly Red Baron had it. I think that was missing a little bit from the Aces titles. So I just wanted to mention that one because it's worth checking out in the standpoint that, or it's worth kind of noting because although it was, you know, technologically inferior and didn't really do anything very well, the mission briefing part of it was really done well to where if you completed whatever the goals were, there was definitely a kind of just more to it than what you had from a lot of the other games. So that I think closes out the World War II stuff. So in kind of a generic sense, moving into the Jet Age, I don't want to go in chronological order. Let's talk about the one that you played. Let's talk about Retaliator. So
let's get the Retaliator out of the way because it's one simulator that played. And to be honest with you, I can barely call it a simulator because it's one of those games that's just, I don't think there's anything simulatory about it, to be honest. It's very arcadey. And it's one of those games where I could figure out the controls and how to do the brakes and how to do the takeoff, not the landing, but the takeoff just by pressing random keys on the keyboard, and eventually it just came to me. So that's a game from Digital Image Design. So they all have that really interesting look where they don't use many colors for some reason for VGA, and they actually dither colors in VGA as well.
Nice.
Makes no sense to me, but maybe it's because they also developed for like Amiga and Atari ST and whatnot.
Yeah.
So Retaliator is... well, it's called F-29 Retaliator, and the F-29 in the game from what it... from what I've read, has nothing to do with F-20, the real plane. So it's a completely fictitious game about at that time a fictitious plane. It's about a fictitious conflict, kind of. It has like different scenarios: the American desert, it's Arizona, then it's the Pacific, the Middle East. And I think the weapons are also fictitious. So basically, nothing about that game is true. Anything remotely. From the way it controls, I don't think it controls realistically at all. But it's really fun to play. Like, the way the environments look and the way that, you know, it has a digital image design art, you know, the 2D art where you can have, like, you know, all the F keys are different points of view, including the one that just, you know, the Top Gun view where it just looks directly in the pilot's face. You know, like the most useless thing. You know, and you could have like tracking missiles where you just like launch a missile and you know, your camera switches to that POV, and stuff like that. You get destructible environments and you can eject, and as you eject, you know, you actually track your pilot all the way down to the ground. And stuff like that. And of course it helped that, it had that function where like if, before I figured out how to, take off, you know, it drops you straight. There are just basically scenarios where you can just be right in the middle of a battle and just take over and stuff like that. And it also had the, null modem, multiplayer.
Nice.
Also pretty unusual for a simulator around that time. So it's also very buggy, but I like it a lot. I used to play it a lot. Decent ad lib music in menus and sort of okayish sound blaster effects, and you know, lots of just nice little touches, like your you know, once you start getting hit, sort of everything on the like the gauges go out and like the control panel starts, like you get static instead of a radar, and you know, it just, I like it, but I'd say calling it a simulator is a bit of a stretch.
Well, that's because I played it too. I didn't play it a bunch, but there's just, look, I mean, certainly there's a time and a place where, all right, if I want to really just crank up the realism and really say, all right, I want to fly a DC-3, you know, which is an airplane from the 30s. It's a twin engine. It's a tail dragger. I want it to look and feel exactly like that. I want the engine noise to be perfect. I'm going to find a DC-3 checklist online, print it out, and go through all this. Well, that's one thing. But I think the great thing about Retaliator is it really is enjoyable. You can just drop right in, and you know, without having to worry about kind of the tropes of a checklist or, you know, getting frustrated trying to figure it out. It just plays really well.
Right.
And
your missions are always just shoot planes and destroy targets.
Right.
And like that's all it really comes down to. It's never like patrol the area and come back and whatever.
Sure.
No, just like shoot enemy planes, destroy a few like ground targets, and you're good.
Yeah, so that's interesting that Digital Image Design, they were able to do that. They produced some pretty realistic simulators, but they were generally fun to play. They weren't super difficult to figure out, and I think Retaliator is a great example of that. So I know that's one that you have a lot of experience with, so I just kind of wanted to get your take on it. But it's also interesting too in that it's somewhat based on, you know, maybe, you know, a piece here or there of existing aircraft or rumored aircraft, but really it's all set in, like you said, in kind of fictitious stuff. Yeah, it's Arizona,
it doesn't really set out to be a simulator of anything. I mean, the conflicts aren't real.
Sure.
The plane isn't, well, it matches the name of a real plane, but it's not supposed to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of this, by doing that, I think it sort of distanced itself, just enough from the serious simulators, enough for it to be like, okay, this is just like, you know, this is just like a fantasy. We're going to give you those overpowered weapons and, this real sort of like really fast plane that doesn't really exist. You know, and we give you plenty of just, sort of fake missions to where you just fly around and just shoot like everything and everyone. So that's what made it fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, looking back now, I can say, well, you know, that's, I can appreciate that, you know, they didn't just say, okay, we're going to do a red flag, you know, like a U.S. military kind of practice type thing, or the Middle East, or kind of the same conflicts or settings that seem to be, you know, most common in the jet simulators or military type sims. So yeah, Retaliator was always fun, and it did have good music. That's true. The menu music was quite good. I remember that. You mentioned that they that was kind of came out in the era where you did have Amiga and Atari ST versions, and that's a really interesting point. I know it's,
oh, the you know what, I haven't mentioned it, that thing ran lightning fast on a 286.
Yeah, it sure did.
It's like, just like other Digital Image Design titles, it really worked.
Well, let's see. So now that we're kind of in the jet era, I'm going to mention just a couple, trying to spend a whole lot of time on them, but again, some that might be overlooked or somewhat forgotten. And the one I'm going to start with is actually an Accolade title, and it's Blue Angels. So I want to say 1988. Don't hold me to that, but this was, you know, Accolade, one of my favorite companies, more for test drive or, you know, some of the Hardball, God, that goes back to the 8-bit days, and Mean 18, and some of these, it's kind of, talk about a really diverse company. I mean, they had, you know, they had adventure games, they had simulators, they had sports games, they really, you know, all in-house did quite a bit, and I'm sure I'm forgetting, you know, quite a few, but I was a big fan of more of the late 80s, early 90s Accolade stuff, but they did Blue Angels, and it's one of the only, I think the only kind of actual game or piece of software that's really looks to try to kind of encapsulate this air show experience, at least from the standpoint of a jet aircraft. Certainly the Extra 300 and these aerobatic, you know, propeller driven aircraft are, you know, they're in quite a few simulators kind of over the years and so on and so forth. But Blue Angels was unique because they tried to really kind of basically teach you how to execute, you know, complicated acrobatic maneuvers in kind of a show setting. And I mention it really more because it was an ambitious game that didn't really translate to the technology of the time that well. It's kind of unfortunate. If it had been a 2 or 3 year later project, even with some of the technology that we saw in Red Baron or later, I really think it would have been much, much, much better. But it's EGA, as far as I can remember. Maybe it was, it would have been EGA, and it was just a little bit too. The premise of the game is really neat. They'll set up kind of these boxes to fly through, and here's how you do the bomb burst maneuver, and you had the other your wingmen and other people in flying in formation. But it sounds like it's such a great idea, but it just wasn't executed all that well, and it's a shame because it really I wish I had kind of better things to say about it. But great idea, really unique sim, certainly still worth at least a look or a quick playthrough in DOSBox or something. But one that I really wish they would kind of revisit, in addition to the airmail notion of solo flight, Blue Angels or some sort of air show type thing where, and maybe this absolutely leads to something that we might see or push for in kind of the dawning of new virtual reality technology. But so much of why Blue Angels didn't really work was, you could hit bracket or some F1 and look to the left, but you really didn't, you never felt like you were kind of entrenched in this realism. And so much of the air show stuff is, you're flying fast, you're a couple of feet from your, the wingman or whatever, and everything is keyed off of the lead pilot. That he actually goes through a cadence, he's talking the whole time, and that combined with the actual movement of the other aircraft is what, when you're all flying in formation, is how those kind of precision maneuvers are executed. And so I'm thinking, certainly in later kind of VGA days, or maybe kind of to the modern day, a project like this would ultimately be more successful and maybe something that would really be a lot of fun to do. But like I said, worth mentioning, but unfortunately it really kind of fell flat. Very kind of happy they tried it, but ultimately just not, it didn't translate into good gameplay, and it just wasn't, you couldn't really see everything well enough to really kind of enjoy it. So kind of unfortunate, but one of those that is often forgotten. And I will say, though, great box art. And I remember on a 286 in 16 color EGA, it ran okay, but it didn't run nearly as well as Retaliator from a frame rate standpoint, so that it just kind of lagged a little bit in that the kind of the curse of kind of late 80s simulators that wasn't quite to VGA yet, hadn't really figured out engine design, and it was hard to make things run well. Kind of an interesting kind of period where things were very jaggy and kind of not very detailed, but still a definitely worth a look. All right, let's see. All right, so I've got other things on the list here, but strangely, from kind of the same year, the same era, but an example of a much richer and better or more well-executed design was the first Jet Fighter game. So there's Jet Fighter 1 and 2. 3, I think, is technically not DOS, but the first Jet Fighter by Velocity Software. Did you ever come in contact with this one?
Nope.
Okay, I won't say too much about it, but kind of an out of the blue. I don't know where Velocity came from, but they appeared, and Jet Fighter 1 and 2. I'll talk to them kind of both. But one, the big kind of selling point for this was you can actually, land on an aircraft carrier, and not in the same way that you could in Microsoft Flight Simulator, where it was very, very difficult, but you could land your 172 on it or Learjet on it or whatever. But this had the catapults, the moving, kind of the pitching of the deck. All of that was really, kind of integral into the design of the game. And for that reason alone, it was just it was a hell of a lot of fun. Just launching off that aircraft carrier, coming back around and trying to land, it was difficult. But boy, was that, they could have just, you know, that would have been the perfect demo. Here's Jet Fighter. You can go do all this stuff, but oh, by the way, you can, you know, take off and land on an aircraft carrier or try. And, that would have been enough. It was just, it was really a very, very, I mean, very great engine. The first one was EGA, but, very, very good frame rate, highly optimized. And it was, they really did a good job. It was, kind of a naval simulator where you could, you know, I'm having trouble recalling the exact aircraft. I want to see you could fly the F-18 and a couple others. The later versions added in the capability to fly the F-14, I think, maybe an F-15 as well. But it kind of not all that important to the general kind of scope. But it had missions and everything else. But this was really made an impression because they really took time and effort to make the operating from in kind of a naval standpoint a focus of the game. And the flight model was good. It was you had afterburners, you had weapons, they all behaved how one would think they would, and they really the selling point was this is very realistic. We have Navy people consulting for us and designing and playtesting the simulators. So Jet Fighter 1 what was quite good. Jet Fighter 2 was very good. It added in more aircraft, slightly the ability to select different weapons for kind of weapons loadout was a little bit more enhanced. And it's a shame. It's such a very interesting and kind of unique game, but where it really to me fell flat in kind of the campaign structure of it. They had missions, they had a campaign mode, but it just wasn't, it was clear that was not the focus of the design of the game. It just wasn't quite immersive enough, but the fact that the aircraft carrier stuff was so neat and so kind of appealing that was kind of enough. So Jet Fighter 1 and 2 were really quite good. That leads me into one that I really want to talk about, which I know you're a bit familiar with, which is the Origin release called Strike Commander.
Yes, that's a very interesting title. I guess my pitch for Strike Commander would be it's like Wing Commander meets Privateer, and that's all wrapped up in the flight sim. Because that's exactly what it is. Structurally, it's kind of like when you go in between stuff, it's kind of like Privateer. But like the talking and like sort of mission briefings and whatnot is handled in the Wing Commander way, and you fly a plane. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think, let's see. So Strike Commander came after Wing Commander 2, but before Wing Commander 3. I think it was in between.
Right.
So I'm guessing maybe 94, I want to say.
Something like that. I don't want to, I didn't play much of it, and it's been a long time. But I also, I'm also almost certain that it's been since released on GOG, so it's a very, very underrated title. You'd think more people knew about it. It looks like not many people actually know it exists, but it's very much worth checking out. Even though I remember it being difficult, that's like my recollection of it. But it's also it's been like 20 years, so. I might be mistaken, but I do remember it being difficult, like more difficult than Wing Commander in many ways. I don't know why, I'm not sure, but that's my memory of it.
It has been 20 years. That's hard to believe. Strike Commander is one of my favorites. It's it really combines all the things that I liked about Wing Commander and story. And it's really it's a very cinematic kind of layout in the same way that really more Wing Commander 2 and the later ones, but kind of tends to be. And I like that. I think that is that the knock on flight simulators is really they can be somewhat boring, that they're beyond the if you don't enjoy completing the task of starting, like I mentioned before, from a cold dark airplane, starting it up and flying from here to there, really that can be a fairly for someone who's not a complete aviation geek like I am, that's maybe that people would look at you like, well, why would you want to do that? There's nothing really exciting about that. You know, you don't interact with anything else. So I always thought that, you know, some sort of a twist or kind of something added to a well-done flight simulator would be welcome. And I'm kind of shocked that it didn't happen more. It's a good simulator. It does skew a little bit towards the arcade notion, but I think they really did a good job given the landscape of the rest of the game and how kind of story-driven it is. They really did a good job. So to know that a lot of resources were not, you know, they didn't have a singular task of like with Jet Fighter or some of these other ones, Falcon 3.0, et cetera, where, you know, 99% of the focus was this has to be realistic, you know, make it realistic. If that means it's not enjoyable for the average player, fine. You know, we're catering towards this, you know, hyper realistic audience, and that's who's going to purchase our game, and that's the standard we're going to be kind of held up to. So I feel Strike Commander probably better than really any other game that attempted to kind of bridge this, whether you want to call it cinematic or kind of dialogue and mission-driven gameplay. Really, the simulator aspect of it is good. And you're right, it is. There are parts of it that are pretty difficult. But I just remember loading it up for the first time, and just the intro, that you know, very nicely rendered, very, you know, kind of origin-style cutscene. You know, if you had, you know, maybe you had speech in there for some of the cutscenes. It's just a really kind of a grand environment, and the artwork, the one that really pops into my head is it's a desert setting. It's kind of an open air hangar, and there's a ceiling fan spinning, and it's just great. You know, and of course you move the mouse, the joystick. Who do you want to talk to? You talk to the weapons lady. All right, you talk to, you know, your wingman, or you talk to the boss, or, you know, oh, so and so's got a mission for you. Let's see what it is. So Origin what was so good at this, and that's that attention to detail and that elusive immersion that I talked about with regard to Flight Unlimited and some of these other ones. I feel like Strike Commander really did a good job of that. And, you know, I mean, the story is, it basically is, it's the privateer story, but in, I don't know, 1996, somewhere in the desert with mercenaries and, you know, everything else. So, I mean, we're not talking about groundbreaking literary stuff here, but it was, you know, it was easy to get kind of hooked in and really invested in kind of the story and the characters. I don't think it was done quite as well as Wing Commander 1 and 2. I mean, in that game, you really had a sense, you really cared about what happened to, at least I did, about, you know, some of your, you know, your colleagues, you know, your wingmen,
right,
whatever else, yeah, so on and so forth. And the branching storyline, or if your missions went poorly, you could still win, but boy, it was going to be difficult. I'm pretty sure Strike Commander had a similar structure. But there was a point, I want to say, right when you started to get to where your missions were, where you were going after naval ships, you're right, it was very tough. And I kind of, you know, Wing Commander had a similar thing where there were some really, really difficult levels.
Oh, yes,
where
they were.
You'd come out, you'd be like, you just get lucky, like, how did I pass that? What did I, you know, 2% left or whatever, and, you know, a torpedo goes off, blows up the capital ship, and somehow you live back. And I want to say Strike Commander was pretty similar. I felt like, you know, very well done. I seem to remember in trying to do some research on the development story of Strike Commander that they were up against a deadline. I know games always are, but I don't know if it was Christmas or something. They had to rush a few things, or maybe it was just falling way behind. So I think in the later missions, you can kind of see that they were kind of like, all right, we got to wrap this up, you know. But certainly a unique title, and very well done from story to, you know, you had, just like Privateer, you had money to manage, money paid for your weapons. You know, if you completed a mission, you got this much, and you could spend that on, you know, kind of ship, on, you know, maybe a different aircraft or more missiles or whatnot. So that resource management aspect of it was, you really didn't have that in Wing Commander. Yeah, sure, you know, you get to a certain point, and then you'd maybe you'd be able to, you know, to fly the saber or something like that. But pre-Privateer, you had this this resource management, just like you said, of to where, you know, your mission success or failure really relates to, well, if you don't, you know, if you can't pay for the Sidewinder missiles or whatever, you're not going to, ultimately, you're probably not going to make it through your next one. I thought everybody played Strike Commander. I had no idea that it was nowhere near as popular. I thought the story aspect of it would be kind of an automatic kind of pull from Wing Commander, but I guess not. Maybe,
I mean, I might be mistaken, but honestly, I didn't have a single friend who played the Strike Commander, and every time I try to like do like a morning DOS talk or anything, like nobody ever talks about it.
Wow. It to me, the great things, and there are many, about Origin, it's just a very grand game.
And it's weird because it's like everybody always talks about either Wing Commander or and or Privateer, but somehow people never really seem to bring up Strike Commander.
Well, that's interesting. It's certainly I think the simulator part of it definitely holds up. Certainly to you know, maybe not quite to the Falcon 3.0 level, but certainly just as, you know, it definitely holds its own, and it's got so many other aspects of gameplay pulled in from either other genres or other Origin games that it really does well. So I think for people who liked Privateer but are maybe looking for a little bit more story, or actually Privateer, it's kind of, you're kind of nebulous, and then once you get to a certain point, then the story really picks up. I think I'm remembering this right. But if you don't get there, it takes a lot of effort to kind of get to that point. And with Strike Commander, you've got the same feedback, you know, mission after mission that you have in Wing Commander and Wing Commander 2. And that was something that they've really, it's one of the reasons I really like Wing Commander 2 in particular, because you really did get that sense. It was like an episodic series almost. You know, you go do your mission, and then, you know, maybe you have a cutscene, or you've got direct feedback from the admiral, from the colonel, whatever it is. And that was good. Wing Commander 2, they had secret missions or additional missions. Strike Commander had the same thing. But that from an immersion and story standpoint, story is not something you'd really associate with flight simulators. You know, very, very hard to come by. And it's a shame that it's not, you know, remembered by more, because I'm always thinking about how, as I mentioned, you could integrate a good simulator or maybe just a portion of that with, you know, a really, really interesting, you know, kind of exploratory type game. I don't think I ever got to the end. I think the last couple of missions were so ridiculously hard that I don't think I ever finished it. So whatever the final cutscene is, I haven't even seen it. I should probably look it up and see if it's on YouTube, see if I can play my way through it. But I actually don't even remember how it ends, but it was kind of interesting enough to where I just could not pass the last one. So I never actually finished it, which is kind of a bummer, kind of ashamed to admit that. But yeah, Strike Commander was a great one. If nothing else, for the, you know, for everybody listening, if you issue all these other flight sims, check that one out, because it really, it's so similar to some of the best Origin titles that I think it's, you know, even if you just kind of ignore the simulation aspect of it, the kind of the lead up and the mission sequence and whatnot is really quite good. So yeah, I like it. I'm kind of shocked more folks haven't played it. So the kind of the pinnacle of realism when we're talking about kind of modern jet simulators is this Falcon series.
Yes.
Spectrum Holobyte, and it is a real, really, really, really great and ambitious and large scale project. Starting with I want to say there's three versions, well, there's really four versions, three that we know of in DOS. There's just the original Falcon, early 90s, notable because the early 90s are such an interesting period in games, because you have the Amiga, the Atari ST, you know, the PC, and all that were, and the Apple IIgs, that all were kind of got, you had to port your game to all these kind of different titles, and the Atari ST version of Falcon, it far superior to kind of what was present on the other platforms. Kind of interesting. I actually just encountered a couple of screenshots and a few notes about it. But I think that the very first version, I'm not all that familiar with, but it is it looks like it's quite good. The ones that I encountered were the version 2 and version 3. The version 2 is Falcon AT, And then coming after that is the kind of the granddaddy of military simulators, Falcon 3.0.
Yeah.
Which,
I wasn't really, none of my friends were that, well, except for a couple, were really that heavy into simulators, and I sure wasn't. But I remember Falcon 3.0 being hailed as like the, as everything, and as the pinnacle of flight sims. And in fact, so much so, like, I don't play it, but I do have it like boxed, and I mention it in like every other podcast that you can kill somebody with that box rather easily.
Oh gosh.
Cause it probably is the heaviest box I have.
I mean, yeah, if, you know, take Red Baron and Aces and just add a few pounds. I mean, it's really
heavy. It's like holding a brick.
So Falcon, I played Falcon AT a little bit. I know, Chris Lapine, was a big player of Falcon AT. I wish I had encountered it kind of more along the way, but 3.0 is really the one that I have the most experience with. And just, you know, Spectrum Holobyte, you know, of course, long gone. This was, they had certainly had other games, other genres, but this was really their flagship product. And, actually Falcon 4.0, which was a Windows product, was also very, you know, highly praised and regarded throughout. But 3.0 had the distinction of having a dynamic, more realistic flight mode that was kind of unlocked or was available to you if you had an 8387 or a floating point processor. And this was, Falcon 3.0 was really in the 386 era. It was, you know, maybe you had a 486 that would come out and do that, but just so much kind of attention to detail. And it was tough. This was one you could, you know, you had the airplane, you could start it up from a cold, dark thing, and get it fired up and go through the sequence. And, what I remember most about Falcon 3.0 was you were surrounded by resources, ground resources, briefings, wingmen. There were so many aspects that were modeled, tanks and vehicles. You could zoom in, you could find out, oh, what's this? This is, you know, zoom in and find it. It's a tank that's going to, you know, attack this or something like that. It just was it's a flight simulator, but it's really a full-fledged military simulation. And, you had air traffic control chatter, or, you know, talk, you know, from your wingmen. You know, a lot of times you'd be shot down and you'd still be getting transmissions coming in from, you know, from somebody flying along still trying to complete the mission. And, I mean, I cannot imagine trying to play this game without a manual. Even with the manual, even with everything open, it was very, very challenging. It's probably off-putting to a great many folks out there. I mean, in the same way that you know, the really, really intense kind of war RPGs or you know, kind of very, very stark tabletop type games where, you know, it was just really, you really had to dig in and invest quite a bit. Mm-hmm. That was kind of how I felt about Falcon 3.0. However, if you could even just figure out how to take off and, you know, head to the target. And it kind of part of the fun was, even with a 600-page manual or whatever it was and all the supporting kind of stuff that was in the box, figuring out how to accomplish the very basic of missions was really rewarding. This was one that I played quite a bit. It was just a tremendous learning curve, but this was one also that had multiplayer. I want to say Falcon AT might have had it. I know Falcon 3.0 did have the capability to play via modem. I'm fairly certain. And that was a kind of a big deal where, you know, you could, you know, possibly, you know, fly along with somebody else over a slow, you know, 2400 baud connection and completely max out your phone line or whatever that was. But, just the notion that all these aspects of kind of a large-scale military operation were present was, of course, it was a just dead-on accurate simulator. They took great pains. This is an F-16. You know, it's going to fly the way, you know, we've got real F-16 pilots, and we've got, you know, the information from General Dynamics, the manufacturer, and everything is going to be poured in. And yeah, it's so realistic. You've got a floating point processor. It's going to be even more realistic. And, you know, it was definitely a challenge, but, I would I remember thinking there was no other simulator or game that even came close to attempting to model a complicated structure with such a kind of rich and detailed flight simulator on top of it. So there were aspects of Falcon that were quite frustrating. It was difficult to proceed through a campaign because even the basic missions were, you know, they were just kind of tough. So this, you know, all the kind of things that we had in the other games, like in Red Baron, you take off and, you know, you could get to, you could kind of, you're navigating to and from the various objectives was made somewhat easy, whether it was by a pointer or something kind of leading you there. You had no such thing in Falcon. I mean, I don't want to say you're on your own, but that kind of increase in the realism level was hard to parse for a lot of people, myself included. But ultimately, just a really fantastic job. I honestly don't know how they managed to get all of that into a package that would run on a 386. And I remember that was another machine killer. That would just, you know, you had wingmen saying things and something exploding, and it would just slow to a crawl. But you know, if you had a fast enough system, 33 megahertz or 40 megahertz, it did pretty well. And sounds and you know, graphics, it was, you know, VGA, but you know, with some kind of, you know, shaded polygons. And I want to say there were it was a very good mix. And I forget the exact title of it, but the kind of the war room or the map or the sequence that you would look at in the briefings was just super detailed. So I mean, just like I said, the granddaddy of realistic flight sims, a great series with kind of an amazing pedigree, and really revolutionary. I didn't ever get the chance to try the multiplayer, but folks who did said it worked pretty well, even over a relatively slow slow connection. So Falcon is it's got to be up there. It's in the photograph for probably best flight sims, and certainly 4.0 was what was pretty good too. I didn't play that one as much, of course, that's Windows, but really have very fond memories of Falcon 3.0. Landing was tough. It was kind of a general sense in most simulators. Landing the plane was tough. You don't have any tactile feedback. Can't look out the window. You know, can't look out the side window. But I seem to remember having flown with. I've never flown the F-16, but some of the folks I fly with have or still do. It's kind of aging, but it's still a very popular, at least domestic kind of military aircraft. And yeah, they said, you know, it flies fast, but it's not the easiest plane to land. You know, in kind of the same, most of the military fighters are not really super easy to land or even to fly slow. So that was effectively modeled, but Falcon was great. And that is one that is recognized. I mean, that's, you know, that'll go down in history for, you know, next 100 years or whatever as a flight sim that people look back and say, yeah, that one was, they really did it well. They might have turned off a lot of players or the, you know, the casual, you know, kind of shoot 'em up type person, but that was the standard that a lot of other flight sims were measured by, and still kind of continue to be. But yeah. How about A-10 Tank Killer? Do you play that?
I have played that long time ago, but I remember it somewhat. I have fun playing it. Like I have pleasant recollections of it.
Yeah, it's you know, they had one and two. I really played one.
I only played one. So, and second one is like way later, right?
Yeah, it was. I'm trying to remember. I don't know if I even had it or maybe a friend had it, but this is kind of it harkens back to the talking about first experience with MS-DOS. I mentioned this a little bit, I think, a couple months ago, but briefly, I actually first encountered A-10 Tank Killer on the family Apple IIgs with a PC Explorer card in the 2GS equivalent of an ISA slot. So it was basically a PC on a card, and you could, you know, choose, all right, do you want to boot up in Apple or PC mode? And the 2GS, I think it had a mega RAM, or maybe it was, yeah. So you could allocate, you know, 512K to the PC card and the rest of it to the Apple machine. And it was CGA graphics. And I remember I said, oh, A10 Tank Killer, this is great. I remember, you know, going to this, you know, Dynamics before, you know, Sierra acquires it. And I thought, oh, this is perfect. You know, the A10, what an interesting, you know, kind of plane and getting to play it. So it was really, it was actually the first kind of DOS game that I played that wasn't, you know, kind of the Flight Simulator version 1 in my own house, not at a friend's house or anything like that. And it was so disappointing looking at the CGA graphics in it. It didn't run really well. That was one of the things that kind of caused us to go, my family to go, all right, we probably need to make the move over to PC. And we did maybe a year later, and then was able to kind of reinstall A10 Tank Killer and see it in VGA. When we started with a 286, and it had VGA capability kind of straight away. Even a lot of the games were still done in EGA, but it did have 256 color capabilities. So A10 Tank Killer is one I remember fondly because having seen it in CGA in kind of a hacked together, not very non-standard environment, and being able to actually run that and see everything in kind of full color was great. And that was a good one. I touched on it briefly before, but, you know, digitized kind of cockpit. I remember you could like see the ejection handle or the kind of the emergency kind of black and yellow striping saying, you know, no push or something like that. And then the early kind of version of the three-space engine where you had you could zoom out and look at the back of the airplane and you see the engines glowing. That was a kind of a neat aspect. But it really played well. The frame rate was good, and honestly, just flying it around in kind of chase plane or kind of that exterior mode, that was fun to do in addition to the missions and stuff. But that in the same way that a lot of these aircraft, the B-17, et cetera, are unique, the A-10 still today has this very unique place in kind of military lore where they said, we need to design a plane that can support, you know, ground forces in a way that's going to allow it not to be shot down. So what should we do? And they said, all right, we're going to take a enormous titanium, you know, enclosure, put the pilot in that and build an airplane around it. And, oh, by the way, we're going to put this unbelievably huge Doom-style, you know, BFG gun that can just, you know, shoot this amazing amount and basically obliterate anything, you know, within its realm. And this revolutionary notion when the A-10 was designed in, you know, the 70s or whatever it was, that we're going to build in, you know, a couple degrees down in the gun just even when you're flying straight level. That was kind of a crucial design element that gets overlooked to where, you know, you had certainly strafing runs or these kind of ground attack missions from, you know, going back to even World War One. Typically, you'd have to, you know, go into a steep dive, do whatever you're going to do, and pull up and kind of rinse, repeat sort of thing. But with the A-10 flying at 200 or 300 feet, you didn't have to. You could fly in a level attitude, and the gun was kind of pre-angled down. So if you saw a tank or saw, you know, a bad guy you needed to get, you didn't have to alter you didn't have to alter your kind of straight and level flight, or at least not in the way that kind of you did in the past. So, a good job. This is interesting. Kind of learned this much later on. The A-10 Tank Killer had a great had a leaderboard, and the other was the kind of digitized picture of the guy in the Air Force uniform, whatever. Said, hey, I'm so and so. I'm going to be giving you your mission statistics and whatever. And I think there's like a tutorial where you see his like a dialogue box pop up, you know, hey, good job. You know, you're ready to go fly missions and go on and go do it. Well, the leaderboard for, you know, how many hits or whatever it is, I don't know, kills or whatever the kind of the semantics of it are, it says it's the Sierra Hotel list. And I remember in the very first mission of the tutorial, you destroy the tank or the something in the bombing range, and the guy goes, Sierra Hotel. Well, that's actually not really what they say. Sierra Hotel is, you know, S is in the phonetic aviation alphabet is Sierra, H is hotel, but it really stands for shit hot, meaning. So if, of course, Sierra couldn't really say that, or Dynamics couldn't put that in the game, but that's what it stands for. So I was reading a book or something about the, you know, the creation of the A10, and I went, oh, so that's what they were talking about. So kind of a little tidbit there, but yeah, the leaderboard is the PG version, not the more profane version that probably people who actually flew the airplane would know. But yeah, A10 was, again, a good showcase of a very early VGA, and it had an EGA version that was good too. That one I actually did see in EGA, and it really stands up pretty well. In terms of the scope of the game, I don't know, you know, if you go through the kind of the initial campaign, there's not a whole bunch you can replay. So it's a much shorter, a much smaller game than Red Baron, but still enjoyable. And for anything else, I mean, I don't think anyone else has done an A10 sim, and it's a very unique and very well loved airplane that doesn't go very fast, and you know, certainly does a kind of a difficult mission, but definitely a good one. And I kind of feel like that was kind of proof that Dynamics could really stand on its own, and after they got acquired, they continued to produce really good stuff, but that it's kind of an interesting one because that was, you know, that was all on their own, and they were, I guess, in pretty bad financial trouble when Sierra kind of stepped in and acquired them. So I'm sure they had other releases before that, pre-Sierra, but A10 is one of the ones that comes to mind as, you know, an example that even without the backing of a very large studio, that they were able to produce something that was pretty good. So.
All right.
Well, I think we're kind of getting towards the end here, or at least close. But there are a couple more MicroPro sims that are probably worth mentioning. So F-15 Strike Eagle, the first one, is in the, we're back to the realm, at least chronology-wise, of Solo Flight. So post Solo Flight, but Sid Meier at MicroPros and a very important partnership with it's Major Bill. I can't remember the last name, but this person that was kind of brought on board and really was a big part of a lot of the MicroPros military flight simulators. And version one, again, I encountered on a different platform on the 8-bit, but it has a lot of the same graphical kind of characteristics as Solo Flight, but just a really, really incredible kind of addition to the very early flight simulators out there. So I won't say a ton about it, but the example from F-15 Strike Eagle that comes to mind is in the same way that Solo Flight really effectively modeled navigation and kind of the actual mechanics of flying that could be done with a very limited kind of graphics palette and hardware and everything else, was this notion that you're flying this fast kind of aircraft on, you know, kind of fighter bomber missions. It could dogfight, it could shoot down airplanes, it could attack ground targets, and that was kind of the versatility of it. It wasn't just a fighter, wasn't just a bomber, it was actually both. Well, as far as flight models and everything, you'd think in the early to mid 80s that pretty limited in what they could do. And I didn't think they had seven theaters, or you had, you know, ranging from kind of easy to hard, and, you know, from like North Korea to, you know, various different places, Saudi Arabia, you know, very, very 1980s, very Cold War, kind of a snapshot in who, you know, who we thought conflicts would be likely with. But in getting on to kind of the more difficult ones where you had maybe multiple targets, or these missions where you barely had enough fuel, I remember I was pretty young. I was playing with my dad looking over my shoulder, and it was one of these kind of difficult bombing runs where we went in, dropped the bombs, blew up the airport, and then had to turn around and come back. And something happened, anti-aircraft fire, you know, some sort of hit that was, I could still fly, but it was, you know, maybe not as fast, or that's what it was. It was kind of, I was losing fuel. So I remember Tim like, Dad, what should I do? He said, all right. Well, he said, why don't you go up as high as you can and, you know, get pointed towards where the airport is. And he said, if you climb up to, you know, 50,000 feet, you know, you're going to burn less fuel and, you know, kind of be able to glide down. So I said, okay, great idea. So I, you know, turn the afterburners on, get up there, and looking at the fuel, I'm like, oh, this is, I'm probably not going to make it. And, you know, whether it was intentional or not, the flight model was sophisticated enough to where, and my dad does not have an aviation background, but it actually worked. I was up at, you know, 50,000 feet. The fuel burn was a lot less. And, you know, certainly you've got a, you know, you're up several miles in the air. And I was able to, I had to actually kind of coast the last couple thousand feet, but I made it. And if not for that, I certainly would have crashed. So that made a very strong impression that even as kind of rudimentary as a lot of the things in F-15 Strike Eagle were, that there was an underlying complexity and kind of richness to the flight model and to what they had. With what they had to work with, they did a really good job, and a really enjoyable game, a great kind of, that's probably the first kind of truly kind of jet simulator I remember playing. And it had several different versions. F-15 Strike Eagle 2 was a more, I want to say 86, 87, somewhere like that. Still pretty good, but then really the best one was 3, and I can't remember if that was Windows or not. I want to say it was still in DOS, F-15 Strike Eagle 3, but that kind of leads more directly into the slew of kind of early to mid-90s Microsoft simulators that, I'm sorry, MicroProse simulators that were all really quite good, but it was kind of the golden age of DOS, kind of the tail end and the best kind of era of the DOS simulators. And I think you've played a few of these, but or seen a couple of them, but starting with the two stealth ones, you've got F-19 and F-117. Did you ever?
I have played both. I actually have both because they were both rather well known in Russia, to the point where F-19 was actually translated into Russian. Well, like it's unofficial translation, but it was one of the few, and maybe one and only translated simulator actually. One thing that I seem to remember about it is nice, sort of chunky EGA graphics, and the fact that the missions were random, right?
Yes, that's right. As far as I can remember, that's right.
Also, I remember when you get caught, there's like a Russian newspaper. I don't know. I've actually never played the English version of that, so I don't know if they actually altered the art for the newspaper for you being caught or that's what the way it was originally. Somebody please leave me a note in comments.
Sure.
But yeah, that's how I'm familiar. And, you know, F-117, I have played that a little bit. It looks great, but I don't really remember a bunch of it.
And that's my takeaway, too. The upgrade in graphics and aesthetics from F-19 to F-117 was really pretty remarkable. A really kind of unique but well done palette for especially the most of the flying was at night. You know, really, really good job on like the runway and the runway lighting, and kind of I want to think a hybrid of textures and polygon stuff. It was very, very, very kind of pretty to look at, and it was a good one. I played F-117 more than F-19, but they were both quite good. Like I mentioned before, that was kind of when MicroProse really hitching its stride. They produced quite a few flight simulators in that time. You know, ranging from the boilerplate, just pick the kind of the new kind of somewhat unknown kind of entry into the into the Air Force or Marines or whatever, to a game that was on the first list that we eventually decided not to talk about. I'll just mention it very briefly, but a game called ATAC, which is actually a kind of an odd mix of flight simulator and kind of almost like it's basically a drug enforcement mm-hmm. kind of.
I looked that one up. I wasn't familiar with it, and that actually looks really interesting. Again, like those things really do stand out. The unusual settings for simulators.
ATAC is worth a look because it was almost like. Do you remember the It was a military game long before Call of Duty or anything. I want to say it was called maybe just SEAL Team.
SEAL Team. SEAL Team is a very underrated and lost title. Really the first 3D squad-based shooter, and honestly the only one for quite a long time.
ATAC was kind of, I felt like, SEAL Team meets insert your, you know, somewhat generic jet simulator. It had huh. aspects of that in it where, you know, if you're kind of going after, all right, you've got a, you know, just the missions were so, and the kind of the premise was so different. It's not maybe quite right in the comparison, but it kind of going that direction where it was, you know, it was kind of unique. But yeah, MicroProse was really, really churning out quite a bit at that point. So we talked about F-15 Strike Eagle, and then really the, I think the best, most complete kind of offering that kind of wrapped up the DOS flight sim era for MicroProse, at least aircraft-wise, was one called F-14 Fleet Defender. Mm. So 94, 95, I think it was a 94, 1994 release. Don't hold me to that. And the iconic F-14, which was, you know, forever cemented into everyone's kind of minds with Top Gun and all the exposure that it got there. And just really graphically was a they had kind of figured it out that, you know, a good way to use, you know, lighting and textures combined with kind of a, not just a straight up Wing Commander 2, you know, like sprite kind of based approach where, you had, you know, polygons with combined with textures that really made for, a realistic looking airplane that didn't, go kind of all pixelated or all jaggy, you know, depending on the camera angle. I remember I spent a lot of time just, looking at the kind of the exterior and the lights blinking, just kind of flying along and you know, having the wings go to, you know, fully out for, you know, subsonic and then back. It was just, it was very well done, kind of a good gameplay, you know, multiplayer capability and, just a really, really well done sim. It was fun. It had enough aspects that, of kind of the mission oriented stuff with, you know, being in the locker room or the, you know, flight suit hanging up and everything else. I think that was actually how you entered the game was you clicked on a locker, and then, you know, your helmet was in there and you could enter your name, so on and so forth. But, just very well executed. It recognized that the F-14 was never designed to be a dogfighter. It was an interceptor, a long-range interceptor, where it could, you know, launch a missile, hit a target a long way away, and more of a protector. So, you know, the stories about aircraft being intercepted and, you know, and flown back into, you know, whatever kind of non-foreign airspace, that was really what the F-14 was for. So the Top Gun depiction, while it certainly had that capability, was not quite realistic to where, you know, there were more agile aircraft that were really designed for kind of close-in dogfighting. But so I felt like, and the F-14 actually got retired from active military service not too long after that. So it was kind of a fitting tribute to an airplane that had been around for a long time. It's kind of on its way out. But and actually, that came out around the same time as B-17. So those were two really good ones to kind of go out on, even though I know it's at least from a DOS standpoint. But that was, you know, those were quite good. I'll briefly touch on just a very quickly go over a few other titles. Mega Fortress is a B-52 simulator, Artec and 3/6 Pacific. It's based on a novel by Dale Brown. It's kind of a fictitious version of the 8-engine B-52 that has this whole kind of backstory. Actually, the game actually came with the book. And in the same way that the B-17 simulator for MicroProse kind of allows this kind of crew management, Megafortress is more of a military kind of simulator with flight aspects in there. It's a really interesting sim. I didn't get a chance to play it that much, but the book is actually a pretty good read as well. Flight of the Intruder in the novel kind of tie-in to the kind of the creating a flight sim is actually a pretty decent one. Well, there is a movie that I like, but only because I like airplanes. It's a movie that came out in the 90s. It's pretty bad. Danny Glover, Rosanna Arquette and Willem Dafoe in one of his very, very underappreciated roles. But it's a shame. It's a good book. Stephen Kuntz wrote it. The simulator, again, or the game actually came with, I think it came with the book and maybe a pass to see the movie or something like that when it came out. Worth mentioning only because the A6 Intruder was a Vietnam-era aircraft. It had nothing defensive on it. It had no guns, no air-to-air missiles. It just had stuff to attack targets on the ground. And the game for, people kind of expect a novel tie-in or something to be not really well done. It's actually pretty decent. It's a pretty well thought out game that kind of loosely follows the, kind of the missions there that are mentioned in the book. But, and then I can't do a Flight Sim podcast without at least mentioning the Electronic Arts Chuck Yeager titles. You had Chuck Yeager's Advanced Flight Trainer. The only thing I'm going to say on that, I didn't actually play that one very much. The namesake, though, Advanced Flight Trainer, is because they were sued by Microsoft when it was Chuck Yeager's Flight Simulator. That Flight Simulator could not be in a title. So that is kind of a ridiculous one. Chuck Yeager's Advanced Flight Trainer kind of falls into that. It was great because it had Yeager with the quotes and everything else, but it has that look kind of similar to Heroes of the 357th, where it's just not quite as visually appealing as some of the other companies. It's decent, but really the game that stands out a couple of years later is Chuck Yeager's Air Combat. And that I only want to mention because it's you can fly aircraft from World War II to Vietnam to kind of modern day, and you can create a very quick scenario. It's the only game I'm aware of that does this, where you can say, the joke is when pilots tell stories, they say, there I was at 37,000 feet. Well, this is quite literally is what you can do. You say, there I was, and you choose, and you've got like five things to choose from. There I was at such and such altitude, I encountered these airplanes. So if you want to take a modern kind of F-111 or something like that, a swing wing jet aircraft, and you want to battle World War II era planes, you can do it and just see how it turns out. And then you get to pick their ability level. So you can basically create millions of permutations of, a dogfight with, four airplanes, five airplanes, this altitude, that altitude, drop in and do it. So there were a lot of other great aspects of that game, but just the quick mission creation of, let's see, can a P-51 have a chance against a jet aircraft or something like that, it was pretty neat. And the artificial intelligence was actually pretty decent. They would for that era, they would follow what they were supposed to do and try to get behind you and shoot you down. So I played quite a bit of Chuck Yeager's Air Combat. That was one that also had the ability to have that kind of view from the ground where you could fly the airplane around almost like you were flying a radio control model, and could good camera view. Still in that one was in VGA, but with the cockpits were somewhat digitized, and then the polygons. But a very good offering. One of Electronic Arts' best offerings as far as flight sims go. And Chuck Yeager's voice and kind of likeness was all over it, which was great. So that's a good one. But that I think that pretty much brings the aircraft portion to the end. But I wanted to chat just a teensy bit about helicopters, which I don't want to neglect.
Let's do that.
I'll throw it to you. You've had some experience with some of these. Are there any that stand out that you really enjoyed over the years?
Honestly, I only played like a few Comanche ones and this. But one that was not on your list is, have you played the LHX?
Yes, I have.
That's the one that was like all over ex-USSR.
That's a great game.
Yeah, and it's also, it's Comanche. The helicopter itself was like top secret. We didn't know it was called Comanche, but yeah, that was a great simulator.
Yeah, it's funny. I was kind of picking on Electronic Arts for their kind of the look of the kind of late 80s simulators, but LHX Attack Chopper, I think is uh-huh. what I knew
yep.
it as. That was just enough before that to where it really looked good. You had, the cockpit, even though it was kind of wireframey.
It was, but you could actually set the detail to maximum.
Yeah, and that's right.
You would actually, things would actually start looking like helicopters in the distance instead of just like a flying polygon.
That, I played, actually my friend and I, my friend Dave and I played a lot of LHX. I think he might have, he might have discovered it before I did, but that was one where it was complicated enough to satisfy the, you know, kind of the people who are really into that, but the gameplay was fun, you know, to go after the helicopters, and it was just really it was done well. And you know, it wasn't extremely easy, but it was easy enough to fly, especially being a heli sim that kind of appealed to both both aspects. So yeah, LHX was I think that came before the Chuck Yeager titles, but very, very well done. Kind of a minimalist palette, but good frame rate, ability to scale detail, and just a really lot of replay value. Just a great one. I'm glad you mentioned that. I would have forgotten that one, but that I played that quite a bit. So then the other one, and there are plenty. And actually, I can't remember the title, but I've referred to the starting up an airplane from a cold, dark situation, having to, you know, turn the key and to put the battery switches on. There is a simulator that it might be a MicroProse title. I think it is. I think it's just called Huey. If it was present in the DOS era, it was probably a booter. It was probably in the Soloflight era. You had to do everything correct to just get the power to come on. But it was pretty neat. So I remember, I think of it like adventure games and puzzles, and this was kind of the ultimate, like, what do I click? You know, it was so hard to see, like, oh, if I turn the, you know, this to this, then it would reward you with this great sound and stuff kind of spooling up. I think it was, I'll have to look that up, but it was kind of one of the very first helicopter sims that I remember, and it was, I'm pretty sure it had a DOS version. But, the one that probably is most memorable to me was almost more like an arcade game, but it was by Novalogic. You referred to it as, I think it was just Comanche. Was it Operation?
Maximum Overkill.
That's right. Comanche Maximum Overkill. So this was the first time I had seen voxels.
Yes.
And man, what
it
what
still a looks good.
It does. It does. It just
somehow the landscape, they managed to nail that sort of landscape film between. They had just enough voxels for it to look sort of volumetric and not, you know, some voxel games really don't really hold up anymore. Some of them just look weird, but somehow Comanche being like that so early, that early on, it still looks good. Like I played it like a couple of years ago and I was like, it still looks really, really good. Very playable too.
Yeah, great. Really good job with the terrain, the greens, and the difference in kind of trees to rivers. Just very well done. Kind of hard to explain. But just one of those where one of those games or simulators you load it up and immediately you're just struck by how just appealing the graphics and
the it also has like this good music and it's rather easy to get into. It's kind of arcadey, so.
Yeah, but you can just jump in and start.
Just start flying around, like fly higher, fly lower, shoot a bunch of tanks.
Yeah. So really remembered for the technology, but it had kind of a rockin', almost like kind of hard rock style soundtrack, and it was good. Definitely enjoyable.
And spawned Novalogic actually took off. That game really took off and was very successful and launched a whole bunch of other things for them using very similar technology, including like a tank simulator.
That's
serious,
right.
Armored Fist and basically their shooter, their first person shooter franchise also came out of it, you know, the Delta Force.
There you go. That's what I couldn't remember. Yeah, they that's right. They were kind of a late entrant into the kind of the DOS era, but really, really did well. So yeah, there are other helicopter sims that are quite good. The ones that model the, you know, collective and torque, very tough to do with just a single four-axis joystick. So, you know, typically you'd have like a joystick mouse kind of setup or a joystick keyboard. And, you know, again, in the same way that looking at the much older simulators, there were some darn good simulators, helicopter simulators that that kind of throughout. I was obviously kind of more taken by the aircraft ones, but There were definitely, I know there are a couple more that I can't recall. There's one called Tomahawk, which I want to say was maybe Data East, or I can't recall, but that that was a wireframe type one, but the animation was so fluid that was a quite good one. Pretty one-sided as far as you just there again, that was one where you had to go through all the steps, turn everything on and whatnot, and really all you did was shoot down helicopters. But it was that was the one where if your Tomahawk was going down at a just a little bit too fast, you'd crash. So the realism for actually landing and hovering and everything was really cranked up. That's the memory I have of that one. So somewhat frustrating, but actually a lot of fun, if somewhat kind of one-dimensional gameplay. So the last thing I'll touch on, and this is kind of breaking the rule on the DOS convention, but all this time playing flight simulators, civilian, military, different kind of in-between type things, it was a later version of Flight Simulator, one of the Windows versions. I think it was Flight Simulator for Windows 98. But there was the capability to have actual air traffic control and all the rest of this. And I'm only mentioning this because the graphics hadn't advanced that far past 5.1. But this notion of this kind of people creating content and uploading it in the kind of the era of the World Wide Web, in kind of early 2000s or thereabouts, when I started flying for the airline that I'm flying for now in a different division on a different aircraft, somebody had created a freeware add-on and modeled the airplane I was flying. It was so complete and done so well that every switch, every position of the switch, everything down to the system schematics and everything had been modeled by someone for free, just to happen to have some programming knowledge. I was so blown away by how well this was done that I said, all right, I've got, we take yearly or once a year or twice a year trek rides where we have to go into the full motion simulator and we're kind of put through the paces of emergencies and whatnot. And I said, I'm going to try to use this freeware package to prepare for the scenarios I'm likely to encounter in the simulator. And I was able to do that, and it helped immensely. So from the standpoint of, I can say I really enjoyed my time with playing flight sims and kind of growing up and seeing them evolve and whatnot. I can actually point to a real honest-to-goodness use that translated into assisting me in my job, to where I was able to actually use it as a true simulator tool, as if I was in the full motion simulator and whatnot. Now, of course, really, it was more of a procedural trainer. I was just, failing an engine and trying to go through, but it was realistic enough and done well enough to where that really provided a lot of value. And the same sort of products exist for the airplane I fly now, but it kind of died on the vine in the FS9, FS10 kind of world, and Microsoft kind of doesn't. They went to the free-to-play model and they quit developing whatever current iteration they have. I think it's Microsoft Flight. So it's kind of sad, but they've really kind of twice now they've said it's kind of end of life for the product, and maybe that will spark some interest. But I just wanted to mention that because I just can kind of tie it back to the real world, that not only has all this just really cultivated a tremendous interest for me in aviation and probably one of the reasons I got into it, but even though it wasn't with an actual DOS title, I was able to kind of put that into use and kind of pull it into real life, which was great. And to be honest, as much as I really enjoy flight sims, the ones that I enjoy are all the ones that I've just talked about. They're all DOS era flight sims. So sadly, I don't actively use them that much anymore. And there's that aspect of it's kind of work is work, and even though it's enjoyable, it's still work. Right. But to see Ben 304 load up Flight Simulator 5.1 and post some musings on that was actually really great. And I feel like the lengthy discussion that we've had about this will kind of rekindle some of my interest in some of these older flight sims and maybe kind of get maybe some other folks interested again. But as somebody who really just loves DOS games, the the amount of the number of flight simulators and different types that were out there, it's really something that I remember fondly. And I don't want to say I'm not interested, because certainly there's hardware coming out, and gosh, all the Star Citizen stuff. And I think there's a way forward with flight sims that is very, very exciting, even if it's just from a kind of a VR standpoint. But it's tough to dig in and try to find any of the titles today, because really the genre is on life support. There really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of interest. You could argue that maybe it was always a niche market, but certainly don't have a steady stream of flight simulators coming out, certainly like happened in the 80s and 90s. And when I think back, it's these games that I really want to play. And that's it's not always the easiest thing to do in DOSBox or anything else. I mean, I would love to have a Pentium machine just sitting around, and I actually do somewhere. I should probably just get it back out and see if I can get a monitor and hook it up and try to play some of these. But it's just to play it in DOSBox, and I mean, it's just not quite as not quite a perfect experience. But certainly, like one like Strike Commander or something like that, I'm definitely gonna have to check out again. But it's good. I appreciate the opportunity to chat about some of these ones that maybe are less well known, and certainly to do it on such a great podcast is an honor. So I appreciate it.
Pleasure is all mine, sir. I was glad to have you. I'm hoping as well that people who will listen to this in its entirety will actually discover, a bunch of, obviously people who will listen are the people who are probably interested in flight sims. So we covered quite a lot of ground with this. So hopefully they'll discover a bunch of new games for them to try out. All of those are great titles. I mean, and yes, this is kind of as niche as the genre was, back in those days, there was quite a lot of output for essentially a not, I guess, very commercial thing. I don't know how true it was. At one point, it looked like simulators were all over the place, and there were like simulators of everything. And all of those games, like I said before, are very technically impressive, most of them. Mm-hmm. So it's, there's also that aspect to see who did what with the technology that was available to them. So yeah, I hope it inspires people to try out new things. I was very happy to have you on the podcast, sir. Maybe we can even do it again sometime.
Yeah, I would love to. Like I said, yours is one that I really enjoy. I'm so glad to see that there are still DOS enthusiasts out there, and you do all of us a great service by by doing this podcast and keeping these kind of DOS memories alive. It's really just great to see. And yeah, definitely had a good time.
Before we part, do you want to tell the listeners where to find you on the World Wide Web?
Oh, sure thing. Yep. Well, the best place is probably Twitter, and that's at CGOApps. I'm on there. I'd like to participate in the morning and evening DOS talk. I have a blog that's more centered around some of the app stuff that I've done, and it's rarely updated. But if they want to check that out, that's at CGOApps.wordpress.com. And that's probably good enough. Hopefully next time, I'd be honored to come on again and talk about some other genre some other time. I'll hopefully have a website by then. Still kind of working on that. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter as well at DOS Nostalgic, or anywhere else when you could Google. Use the search engine of your choice to search for DOS Nostalgia. Any of the sources are probably good to contact me. And if you have a topic that you'd like to discuss on a podcast, don't hesitate to contact me and we'll work something out. And you too can be here talking about stuff that you like, that somebody will listen to and enjoy. So again, it's been a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much for participating.
Thank you. This was. I just had a great time talking about all this. So many good memories, especially from a long time ago. So thank you.
And thank you for listening. And hopefully we'll meet again on another episode of the DOS Nostalgia Podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.